will Sting the Superstar in the flesh ever step foot in a WWE ring?
There's been a lot of speculation over the years. I'd heard that Bruno Sammartino would never be part of the WWE again. I heard for years that the Ultimate Warrior would never be part of the WWE again. And I've also heard that Sting would never, ever be part of the WWE. But there's one thing I've learned over the years. Never say never if it's best for business.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the streak.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
He's fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 337 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, July 20th, 2014, Battleground Sunday. I am the Solid Monster. Thank you, as always, for downloading the podcast, which you can listen to each and every Sunday on thesolidmonster.com, Stitcher Radio, iTunes, Player.fm, and now we are officially on TuneIn Radio. So I don't know how many of you people use TuneIn. I know some of you do. If you go on to the TuneIn website or the TuneIn app on your phone and type in Solid Monster Sounds Off, our official page is now up. There are no episodes listed as of this moment, although I'm told in the next 24 hours or so, they should be pushed there. But you can go on the page right now and start following us, and it's just another way to listen to the show. Always looking for new places to expand our listening audience. So TuneIn Radio, we are now officially on there as well. Got some PayPal shout-outs to get through here before we get to the predictions for the big pay-per-view tonight. PayPal shout-outs for people who have donated to the show via thesolidmonster.com. That is where the PayPal donation box is if you want to support the show that way. Antoine Moore, Daniel Janaid, Gerald the Muscle Morgan, the Prime Minister of Pain, Von Bowen, Fabulous Fabian Pristov, Razorblade Trevor Johnson, Tyler Parts Unknown Udy, Michael the Menace Avila, Michael Sergeant Pepper, Craig Pitbull Brown, William the Handyman Hayden, Sheer Excellence Edward Brooks, Battle-Tested Brandon Foley, Filthy Rich Richard Sanders, Adrenaline Junkie Andrew Muller. This sounds like a Royal Rumble lineup here. And one last special shout-out to Dwayne Reibling from our Facebook group, who lost his father, Edsel Reibling, on Thursday, 72 years young. Dwayne said that he would love to get his dad a nickname to use in a lighthearted speech at his service. And I felt bad about some trolling that went down in the group from a select few that have since been excommunicated from said Facebook group. And so I asked Dwayne to tell me some things about his dad. He grew up the youngest of 11 children on a farm in Michigan. He was the Owen Hart of the family, I guess you would say. Bought and ran a grocery store, became a salesman, retired as a hospital worker. And when I hear all of that, I think of son of a plumber, right? You think of Dusty Rhodes back in the day. I think of the common man, and that's exactly what he was, doing what he had to support his family. So I hereby dub him the common man, Edsel Reibling. And again, Dwayne, my condolences for your loss. Hope you like the nickname. That one's on me. If you want to make a contribution to the Sound Off via PayPal, you can always do so on thesolidmonster.com. That's where the box is, 24/7. Give what you can, whenever you want to. It's entirely up to you. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname like many of the ones you heard here. A lot of very eclectic characters. Or you can sign up for an Audible trial. Audibletrial.com/Solid Monster is our custom URL. You punch that in, follow through, sign up, and we get a little something for that. Every time somebody signs up, you get one free audiobook. It's up to you whether or not you want to stick with the service or not. I've gotten tweets and messages from people who say they love it, and they've found books that they listen to all the time now, and that's really cool. And June was actually our biggest month. You know, we've been doing the Audible thing now since the beginning of the year. June was our biggest month in terms of signups, and so July may not quite come as close. We have a shot. We have a little bit of time left in the month of July. I guess my goal would be to try to match what we did in June, and we're not quite there yet, but it is doable. So if you want to sign up, audibletrial.com/Solid Monster. I also want to mention that I recorded 75 minutes of bonus audio this past week, the first edition of the Sound Off Inbox on our YouTube channel. I've been promising that for a while. finally had some free time, got around to answering, I think it was about 22 questions that you guys have sent in of the 22,000, it feels like, that are still sitting in my inbox. So hopefully I'll be doing more of these. But the first Sound Off inbox is up. It is 75 minutes long. You can also subscribe to our YouTube channel when you're up there. I posted another vintage episode of the Sound Off, what I call the lost episodes because they're not available anymore anywhere else. The first 9 episodes of the Sound Off, all the 2007 shows, and now the first one from 2008 are now available on our YouTube channel in full. So again, Solomonster Sounds Off is the full title of the podcast. Obviously, if you type that in YouTube, I'm sure you'll find one of our videos. Subscribe to our channel from there, and every time a new one goes up, you will be notified. Let's talk about Battleground, which is the big WWE pay-per-view coming up tonight on the WWE Network. It is still on pay-per-view, although they're not hyping it that way. They want as many people signing up for the network as possible. So I don't think they've even referred to Battleground as a pay-per-view even one time in the last couple of weeks. Remember Money in the Bank last month? They couldn't shut up. It was the Money in the Bank pay-per-view, Money in the Bank pay-per-view. All of a sudden, it's not a pay-per-view anymore, apparently. So I want to go through this from top to bottom. We'll start with the main event, and we'll go match by match, and I'll give my thoughts on this. And I want to start with the main event because I think this is the biggest deal of all. You know, what's going to happen with the WWE Championship heading into SummerSlam? It seemed like a no-brainer that John Cena, who just won his 15th title last month, would retain the title and go on to likely defend against Brock Lesnar at SummerSlam. That's been the big rumored match for a while. It's, I think, the right match in terms of matching up the two biggest stars in the company, mainstream stars in the company. And I do think we are going to get a John Cena-Brock Lesnar match at SummerSlam. However, some things have changed. At least I think some things have changed. I'm not saying I have any inside information here. So I've given this a lot of thought the last few days, and I've actually kind of tweaked my predictions. And here's what I think is going to end up happening tonight. And I could easily look foolish when all is said and done, but this is what I think happens in the main event. I don't think that John Cena leaves Tampa tonight the WWE champion. I didn't say that he's going to lose the main event. I do think he wins the four-way. I don't think Roman Reigns gets the belt. I don't think Randy Orton gets the belt. I surely don't think Kane gets the belt. I mean, he's just in there as a warm body. They're doing their thing where there's a lot of distrust within the authority. And I'm sure there'll be something that goes down with Kane and Orton. They turn on each other and what have you. They've kind of been playing that story up on TV. But they sure do want to make you believe that Roman Reigns is walking out the WWE champion. Now, if Roman Reigns were to walk out the WWE champion, that's fine. You know, he's a new face. They see him as the next big thing. Would not be at all shocked if he did leave with the title. I'm not going to say I would be standing here with my mouth wide open. It could happen. I think it's too early. I think it would be a mistake to put the title on him so soon. But it could happen. The way I see this going down is John Cena wins the match. You know, Orton and Kane kind of cancel each other out. Authority does not want Roman Reigns winning the championship. So whoever interferes, whatever happens, maybe Triple H himself, because I think the end game here is a match between Reigns and Triple H. But whatever happens, Cena wins. Cena retains the title. Now, we heard this talk on Raw Monday of Plan C. Paul Heyman extending the option for Plan C to Triple H in case Plan B doesn't go according to plan. Plan B being that Cena loses the match. Well, Plan C is Brock Lesnar. Brock Lesnar is supposed to be on Raw this Monday night, which means he's going to be, if he isn't already, I'm sure he is by now, in the state of Florida. I don't know exactly where Brock is, but he's going to be, I think Raw Monday is in Miami, which is the site that he made his comeback at 2012 on Raw. I was at that show, the American Airlines Arena. So he's in the state of Florida. Brock will be there. It is not out of the realm of possibility that Brock Lesnar could make a surprise appearance at Battleground tonight, and in fact, I think he will. I think that the appearance comes when the match is over. I think Cena wins, then Brock comes out, lays out Cena, probably with an F5, and that allows Seth Rollins to come out and cash in his Money in the Bank briefcase. And as far as Dean Ambrose, because again, there's a big Rollins-Ambrose match tonight that I think Ambrose is winning, and we'll get to that in a second. Maybe Ambrose is out of the picture because he was hurt in the match earlier in the show. Maybe he got taken out backstage by Brock before Brock comes out. Whatever, you can come up with a legitimate excuse as to why Ambrose would not come out to foil Rollins' cash-in attempt. Or maybe he does, but he gets cut off by somebody. But Rollins comes out to cash in, and Seth Rollins beats John Cena to become the new WWE World Heavyweight Champion. That's my prediction. Cena wins the four-way, Brock comes out, lays him out, Rollins cashes in, Ambrose is not there to fuck it up for him. Rollins wins, and he is the new champion. I think Seth Rollins is leaving Battleground with the title, and I'm okay with that if that happens. Because much like Roman Reigns, it's a new face, it's a fresh face. I don't think that anybody would have predicted when the Shield broke up that of those three members, Seth Rollins would be the first to win the championship. I don't know how many people are really expecting that to happen tonight. Probably a lot of people who are expecting that Rollins will cash in at some point and will fail, which I think would be a mistake. So Rollins getting the title is not as far-fetched as it may sound to some people, and I'll tell you why. SummerSlam is going to be headlined by John Cena and Brock Lesnar. I think SummerSlam will probably be headlined by Cena and Lesnar in a non-title match. You've got Rollins defending the championship underneath against Ambrose. That's your championship match. And you've got Roman Reigns against either Triple H, or if they want to hold off on that match, you could do Roman Reigns and Randy Orton. And those are your three top matches that headline SummerSlam next month. And here's the reasons behind it. John Cena is not scheduled to be on Raw this Monday night, so you may all now rejoice. He is filming a movie. I think he's filming a couple of movies, actually, one of which is a Judd Apatow movie. So he's not even scheduled to be on the show this Monday, although Brock is. That, coupled with the fact that the SummerSlam commercial that leaked a couple weeks ago, promoting the Cena vs. Lesnar match, not one time in that commercial was it billed as a championship match. And somebody pointed that out to me on Twitter right after it leaked, and I posted a link, and I said, that is an interesting point. I didn't really think anything of it at first. It doesn't necessarily mean it won't be a title match, but you would think that if you were building up a big match like that, and they knew, you know, I'm sure they didn't want that to leak as early as it did, why wouldn't they bill that as a match for the WWE World Heavyweight Championship? It just seemed kind of odd to me. And then I hear that Cena is filming a movie. He's not even going to be on the show on Monday. And all of a sudden, my mind starts to think, okay, something doesn't add up here. Okay, that's what first got me thinking that something was up when I realized that in that commercial that leaked. Once I read that Cena was missing Raw this week and possibly even another two or three Raws leading up to SummerSlam, that's when I said, okay, they're changing the title. And on top of that, there's a third reason. And that is that as much as I'd like to see Brock win the title at SummerSlam and run with it through WrestleMania, I don't see a realistic path to making that happen. You know, there's no way that this guy, who Paul Heyman loves to talk about, hates people, okay, and he lives in seclusion. He practically lives in a cave, a very nice cave, I'm sure, but you know, this guy does not like travel. He does not like people. He likes his deal as it is. He works, you know, a handful of dates every year. I don't think it's money with him. It's business. He wants to make as much money as he can. So it is about money. I can't say it's not. But I really think that even more than the money, he hates travel so much. I mean, he gave up a lucrative career at the peak of his career, in his prime, 8 years ago. I guess now it's more. It's like 10 years ago. He just said, I quit, and he up and left. And he was one of the top guys. He was the champion at the time. And to do something like that, the guy really has to hate that lifestyle. It's not just, well, I kind of hate the travel, but I'm making such good money, I'll stick with it. He just said, you know what, I hate this. I don't want to do this anymore, so I'm going to give it up. A lot of people would not do the same thing that Brock did. Brock is very rare in that way. So this notion, as I try to go over the scenarios in my head, how to make that work if Brock wins the belt in August and really should not be beaten until WrestleMania, that's a long stretch of time. What is that, 8 months, 9 months? That is a long stretch of time. And I'm trying in my head to figure out ways to make it work, and I just cannot envision a scenario where he agrees to enough extra Raw dates, enough extra pay-per-view dates. House shows, you can forget about that. That's not going to happen. It just doesn't work because he's not going to do it. I don't care how much money you throw at the guy. And you can't put the belt on a guy for 8 months if he's not willing to work more dates. You just can't do it. you know, when Daniel Bryan was hurt and we didn't know how long he was going to be out for, I did a whole column, you know, for PW Mania talking about how if he's going to be out until SummerSlam, or maybe he'll be back before SummerSlam, don't strip him of the belt. Keep the belt on him. I pitched this idea for a tournament, maybe even a King of the Ring, to try to make that mean something again, to build to your number one contender, and then you've got this ready-made SummerSlam match, and then it became obvious that Bryan is unfortunately not going to be back anytime soon. He may not even be back this year, if at all. And then it's like, well, now you've got to take the title off him. Now you have no choice. This, I mean, there's a big difference between 3 months and 8 months. Okay, there's a big difference there. And you just can't do that. Now, I can still see Brock winning the title next year and defending it against Roman Reigns at WrestleMania if that's the match they want to do. Brock winning the belt at the Rumble is absolutely doable. They did it with The Rock. They could do it with him. 2 to 3 months is not nearly as big a deal as 6 to 8 months. Okay, that's very different. And so if Brock's not winning the title, then I don't want to see him in a title match with Cena at SummerSlam, because that means Brock loses, and Brock should not lose before WrestleMania. So that's three reasons right there to believe that John Cena is dropping the title at Battleground. Plus, if Cena retains the title and he doesn't show up on Raw Monday, but Brock does, and they just announce him as the number one contender without Cena being there to get laid out or something like that, it just doesn't make sense to me. You would want to have that big angle at the end of the show where Cena gets laid out. Or Cena is at least there to go toe-to-toe, you know, verbally with Brock or something. If he's not there at all, I don't know, it just doesn't seem to make sense to me. It would make more sense for Brock to do the surprise run-in tonight, cost him the title, then show up the next night to gloat and set up a straight singles match between the two for SummerSlam. And maybe the story there is Brock hasn't forgotten Extreme Rules 2 years ago, and he wants his win back. You know, it's kept him up at night, and you know, ever since he's just dreamt of revenge on Cena. I mean, you can come up with something that, you know, goes back to that first match, which Cena won, and that could be the story for the match instead of it being about the championship. And yes, that means that Rollins gets the CM Punk treatment on top, but that's just the way it is. You know, Cena versus Lesnar, title or no title, is the main attraction if that's the match they do at SummerSlam. That's got to be the number one match. I mean, this guy ended The Undertaker's undefeated streak. John Cena, like him or not, is still the number one guy in the company. That is the top match at SummerSlam. Rollins at Ambrose, you know, for my money, is the hottest feud going right now in WWE. It's the match that I'm most looking forward to on this show. Some would argue that Ambrose, and not Roman Reigns, is the true number two babyface in the company right now. If he's not number two, he's number three. And that's not a bad place to be. The people love him. They would absolutely get behind seeing him go after Rollins for the championship. That could be a solid number two match for the title at SummerSlam behind Cena and Brock. Meanwhile, you do Reigns versus Triple H at SummerSlam, or if you want to save that match for September, you know, when people are hopefully renewing their network subscriptions and they want to really load up that Night of Champions show. Like I said before, you could do Reigns and Orton. Because what else is Orton going to do anyway? You could do Reigns and Orton at SummerSlam, and then save the Triple H Reigns match for September if that's the way they want to go. It just all seems to fit to me. So I say Cena wins the four-way, Plan C kicks in, Brock lays him out, Rollins cashes in, wins the championship, and that's how you go off the air. That's my prediction for the main event. We have a 2 out of 3 falls match for the tag team titles, the Usos and the Wyatt family. I think it's time. The Wyatts have lost, I think, far too many matches, and I like the Usos as the champs, but something's got to give at some point, so I think the Wyatts finally go over here. They win the tag team titles. AJ Lee defending the Divas title against Paige. I think AJ retains. It's too early for her to lose it back. Although I do expect that the Paige heel turn will become official on this show, either during the match or after the match, especially if she loses. Battle Royal to crown a new Intercontinental Champion. We have Sheamus, Cesaro, RVD, The Great Khali, Ryback, Curtis Axel, Bo Dallas, Kofi Kingston, Dolph Ziggler, Big E, Fandango, Alberto Del Rio, Sin Cara, Zack Ryder, The Miz, Diego, I think Fernando is still out hurt, R-Truth, Xavier Woods, Heath Slater, and Titus O'Neil. Damian Sandow and Adam Rose, I believe, have been pulled from the Battle Royal, so we now have an even 20 men. I say good. I would have pulled him, too, after that horrendous Sonic skit on Raw Monday night. My pick for the Battle Royal, I know that, you know, a lot of people think Cesaro's winning. It would make sense. He's been losing every single week. They sometimes do that when somebody's in line for a big push or a big title win. It's like, they can lose because they're going to win anyway in the end. I still say that Bo Dallas should win this Battle Royal, and I'm going to go with Bo Dallas as my pick. And I think even more so now because they announced on Monday night that Wade Barrett, who is recuperating from surgery, is going to be there. He's going to be at the pay-per-view to hand the Intercontinental title over to the new champion. He will present the belt to the new champion. Could easily see Bo Dallas taking the title, being all cheesy, telling, you know, Wade Barrett, you know, get better soon, I know you can make it back, and then Wade Barrett just lays him out with a bullhammer elbow, gets a big pop, turns babyface. I think we're going to see it. And I think, you know, for Bo Dallas, yes, he's being played up as a comedy character, but you know what? He's got something. People are into him. Some people hate him. They want to see him lose. He's got his little undefeated streak going on right now. At some point, what they're doing with him gets old, and you've got to change it up, and you've got to do something different. I think the way to, you know, do something different is to put the Intercontinental title on him. It's very similar, I think, to the Honky Tonk Man thing back in 87, where they put the belt on him. He really was a comedy character in a lot of ways. I mean, not too many people took the Honky Tonk Man seriously. They tried him out as a babyface. It didn't work. The people turned on him. He turned heel. See, does this all sound familiar? Okay? Same thing happened to Bo Dallas in NXT. People got sick and tired of him. They didn't like him as a babyface. They literally started turning their backs on him during some of the NXT shows. Now he plays this thing where he thinks the people love him. He's very full of himself and just delusional, but very entertaining nonetheless. But people couldn't wait to see the Honky Tonk Man lose. And he went on this long streak, 14 months as the Intercontinental Champion, and when the time was right, the Warrior beat him in 30 seconds. I think Bo Dallas can follow a similar pattern. I'm not saying he'll be the Intercontinental Champion for a year, but you've got to do something different with him before what he's doing now gets very old. Put the title on him. It'll make people hate him even more. And it'll mean so much more to the babyface who finally comes along months down the road and takes that title from him, and maybe it's Wade Barrett. If Barrett's going to be out for 4 months, 6 months, and they can keep the title on Dallas for that long and keep this little undefeated streak going, how much bigger would that make Wade Barrett when he comes back as a babyface, knocks the shit out of Bo Dallas, takes back the title? Now he's even bigger than he was before he got hurt. So I think Bo Dallas would make sense. And you know what? I don't need to see Cesaro with the Intercontinental title. For Bo Dallas, I think it would be good for him. For a guy like Cesaro, he's already above that level. The only thing the Intercontinental title can do to him is drag him down even more. He has lost so much momentum since WrestleMania. And maybe they just figure that, hey, it's not a big deal because we're going to turn him babyface at some point. You know, maybe that's the mentality there. I hope they're right. I hope that, you know, you can flip the light switch one day and he'll start swinging people again and the fans will get behind him and we'll forget about these last few months. But if not, what a waste of talent. And as we've seen with Big E and people before who have held this title because they don't treat the title like it means anything, the title only drags you down further. Same thing with the U.S. title. So do we really want to see Cesaro win the Intercontinental title? This is not the Intercontinental title from 15 years ago, people. Okay? This thing is like the fucking Hope Diamond. Stay away. For Bo Dallas, though, like I said, he's a comedy character. It doesn't matter. You could put the title on him, and it's not going to drag him down any lower. It'll probably just make him even more annoying and more entertaining. So put the title on him. Seth Rollins and Dean Ambrose. I think Ambrose is going over here. Ambrose has gotten his ass kicked quite a bit on television the last several weeks. They've busted up his shoulder. They killed him dead in the opening segment on Raw Monday night to the point where he didn't even run out at the end to make the save in the main event. He just never showed up again. I don't know what he did on SmackDown, though. I didn't watch SmackDown on Friday, but I think Ambrose is due for a big win. He lost to Randy Orton on TV a few weeks ago. I know Orton's in the main event on this pay-per-view. I said it before. Why even do the fucking match? Dean Ambrose should not have lost that match clean the way he did, but he did. He needs a big win. And you know what? If Rollins is going to come out and cash in at the end of the show, then it doesn't even matter. All it does, it gives Ambrose a big win. And it puts him in the position to say, hey, I beat you, and now you're the champion. That makes me the number one contender, and it makes perfect sense. And you set that matchup for SummerSlam. So I think Ambrose goes over here. Chris Jericho and Bray Wyatt. Most people probably think Bray Wyatt's getting the win. Maybe he is. Jericho has come back before to put people over and lose and lose and lose some more. Although he did beat The Miz, but it's The Miz. I think Chris Jericho wins this match. I don't know how. I don't know if it's, you know, a roll-up or a DQ with interference from Harper and Rowan. I can't predict that. But I do think that Jericho's winning this match. And the reason I say that is I would have to think that at SummerSlam they're going to have another match, maybe a gimmick match. And in the end, Bray Wyatt should win that big match. Maybe they even do a series of three. And this is the first one. They do a second one at SummerSlam, one more at Night of Champions. Bray should win the final two. Decisively should win the feud. But if this is the first of a series of matches, Jericho needs a big win. You know, you can bring back a guy like Jericho. You can bring back RVD. People are still, you know, they still see these guys as main event players. They come out, they get a big reaction. The problem is, how often are they supposed to lose before it doesn't mean anything anymore? If Jericho comes back and loses every single match, what good does it do? If RVD comes back and loses every single match, what good does it do? Now, I'm fine with what they've done with RVD. You know, he's lost to Rusev. Rusev is on the rise, right? That's fine. I think Van Damme lost to Del Rio. I guess we'll get into that in the Raw review. Whatever. I mean, I guess they're both in the Intercontinental Battle Royal. That's fine. But Jericho needs a big, big win, I think, before he loses. Because I think that only helps Wyatt. I really do. I think if they go out there tonight, have a kick-ass match, Jericho ekes out a victory. I wouldn't have Wyatt tap out to the walls of Jericho in the middle of the ring. Ekes out a win. Jericho does. Leads to a rematch. Wyatt wins. Maybe a third match. Wyatt wins. That's how you elevate the guy. But Jericho has to win. He's got to win one. And I think this is the one to win, so I'm going to go with Jericho here. We have Rusev and Jack Swagger. This is probably my second most anticipated match on the show. Who the hell would have thought that a month ago? Jack Swagger and Rusev, for that matter, would be involved in one of the matches I was most looking forward to on this pay-per-view. But it is. The people have taken to Swagger and Zeb. Maybe it's more them just cheering the flag and the country more than Swagger, but I don't know. He's getting a lot of Let's Go Swagger chants. He is the most over that he has been at any point in his career here, Jack Swagger, his first time playing babyface. I don't know how long it's going to last. Chances are when Rusev beats him and this feud is over, Swagger's going to go right back down to where he is. I hope not. I hope if he still has this heat when the feud is over, they can somehow find a way to, you know, to maintain it and do something with him if the fans are behind him. But this may be his only real shining moment here in this feud. And I think they're going to go out there. Two big guys. Swagger's a big guy. Rusev's a big guy. We saw a big guy versus big guy match. I think a Payback it was. Was it Payback or Money in the Bank with Rusev and Big E? That match impressed me. I didn't expect it to be as good as it was. When you get two big bulls out there beating the crap out of each other, you know, usually the end result is a pretty good match. So I think they'll have a good match. But Rusev has to win. I think he will. Hopefully not as quickly as he's been winning on some of these house shows. I heard that they had a house show here at Madison Square Garden a week ago. And they had a Rusev Swagger match that went literally 30 seconds before Rusev beat him. I don't know what the deal was there. They need to give this a little bit of time. But Rusev should win. Rusev will win. I would suggest they tone it down on the Vladimir Putin love. I've gotten a lot of questions from you guys this week. Is this the end of Rusev? Are they going to kill the character off because of what happened with that plane that got shot down over Ukraine? And there's a lot of finger-pointing going on at Putin and the Russian government. And whoever was behind it, whatever happened, it was a terrible tragedy. And it's unfortunate timing for WWE. They happen to be really promoting this Russian character and putting Putin's frickin' face up on the Titantron every single week. I see no reason to kill off the character. You know, he's Bulgarian, I guess, but he's a Russian character on TV. So what? Why do you have to kill off the character because of that? This is not Muhammad Hassan in 2005, where there was a terrible tragedy. I think it was it in London? There was a terror attack, and I think that week on SmackDown, because it may have already been taped, although they could have pulled the fucking tape, but they didn't. And they aired this stupid, dumb shit angle where Hassan was feuding with The Undertaker at the time, and so these guys dressed up in, like, black ski masks, looking like members of Al-Qaeda, came into the ring to attack The Undertaker. I mean, just the stupidest possible angle you could possibly do. They dressed these guys up as terrorists in a week where there was a terrorist attack. And so they got a lot of heat for it, and that was one of the things that led to the downfall of the Hassan character, because UPN, which aired SmackDown at the time, said, no more. We don't want this on our show. And I believe he was part of the SmackDown brand, and that was the beginning of the end for the character. This is not quite the same thing. I think all they need to do is tone down the love for Putin. Don't put his face up on the screen anymore. Don't talk about Vladimir Putin, okay? Just stick to the other aspects of the character. Russia versus the U.S., okay, the super athlete, all that kind of crap. There's no reason to end the angle, to kill off the character. Just make a little tweak, be smart about it, and it'll be fine. The guy has heat. He's getting over. It's working. It would be a shame to kill it off now just because, you know, some unfortunate events happened and they panicked and they overreacted to it, when all you have to do, just make a few changes. That's all you got to do. The pre-show match is Cameron versus Naomi. I figure Cameron is going over here. I mean, Naomi is much better than Cameron, but Cameron, if they're trying to get her over, and maybe they're not. You know, maybe they broke him up, and the idea is that Naomi is going to get pushed, and Cameron is just going to kind of fall to the wayside. But I could see them trying to get her over as this really annoying heel, probably like the character I imagine she plays on Total Divas. So I think Cameron gets the win in the pre-show match, and that's the card. We'll see if they add any matches at the last minute or if they do any more awful product placement, which I'm sure they will, especially if Adam Rose and Sandow have been bumped from the Battle Royal, which is what I had read a few days ago. Their role on the show may well just end up being some kind of BS product placement, so poor Sandow. Monday Night Raw this past week was in Richmond, Virginia. This was the go-home show to Battleground. Not a very good show. The most noteworthy thing coming out of it was Sting's debut in a commercial for the new 2K15 video game. I thought this commercial was fantastic. We had heard about the casting call in June. People thought, oh, this means Sting's going to be on Raw. But what they were looking for was an orchestra to perform, some Sting lookalikes. They were looking for some big, I think, muscular body doubles. I don't know what happened to the body doubles. My only guess is that they probably filmed more than one commercial. I heard the shoot cost like $200,000, although I think 2K paid for it, not WWE. Some ridiculous amount of money like that. I would have to think they filmed two or three different commercials that will air over the next few weeks. Maybe one of those commercials has a Sting body double. But it was the real Sting in the flesh here. They had the orchestra performing his old Crow music. From the first chord, it was awesome. And Sting, I think, lowered. They didn't show him lowering, but you see a shadow lowering from a rooftop or a ceiling. And they stop playing. They all turn around, all the performers in the orchestra. They're wearing Sting masks or face paint, whatever it was. And then we see a shot of the real Sting. He didn't speak. It was very brief, maybe a three-second shot. I thought it was very well done. It gave me goosebumps. It was really, really cool. People reacted to it. They kept the crowd noise in. As soon as, even before Sting appeared, I think from the moment they started playing his music, people started reacting. But it was when they all the members of the orchestra turned around and people saw them with the Sting face paint on that people in the building went nuts. Then they showed Sting. And the only time they booed was when people realized, oh shit, it's just a video game commercial. They thought maybe it was a vignette for his imminent debut. And in fact, it was not. And that's when they turned on the ad and they started booing it. So he got a reaction that you would not expect a guy to get who has not one time ever stepped foot in a WWE ring. So clearly people know who Sting is. Maybe it's all the WCW footage on the network. You know, all the kids and all the younger people who don't know of him now know of him. You know, I don't know. They haven't done a DVD for Sting. They haven't talked about him very much. But I never once doubted that Sting was going to get a big reaction for his first appearance because he's a big star. Most people know who he is. And you know what? Go back even before this video game commercial. Go back. It was either last year or the year before. I think it was last year. Would have been shortly after Hulk Hogan left TNA. It was one of the pay-per-views, maybe the pay-per-view in October. It might have actually been the Battleground show in October. They were doing these interactive fan polls where you can vote on who you think is the greatest world heavyweight champion and who you think is the greatest WWE champion. And in one of the polls, Hulk Hogan was an option. I think Hogan won the poll. And maybe it was for the United States title. Who was the greatest U.S. champion of all time? Sting was one of the options. And Sting won. Hogan and Sting won. And both of them were in TNA, or Hogan had just left TNA. So Sting won the poll, and that was back in October. So I always knew, people know who the guy is. You know, he's just this iconic figure in wrestling, and when he appears, he's going to get a big pop. And this was just a video game commercial, and he got a big pop. And I'm sure that, you know, the day that he sets foot in an arena for the first time, he's going to get a great ovation. And it's going to happen. I mean, I don't care whether he, you read reports he still hasn't signed, but he's close, or he probably hasn't. You know, I believe that. I believe he hasn't signed a wrestler contract yet. He has some other contract with 2K, and he's probably still negotiating and talking to WWE, and maybe wants a little more money than what they're willing to give him. But he wants to come in, and they want him in. And you heard the audio I played from that Triple H interview with Michael Cole at the beginning of the podcast. Triple H would not be doing interviews on .com teasing people that, you know, well, if it's best for business, you know, we'll get Sting inside a WWE ring. I mean, Michael Cole flat out asked him, okay, enough about the video game, when, or, you know, if we will ever see Sting inside a WWE ring. They wouldn't even ask the question if they didn't think they either had him or we're going to bring him in. Don't worry, it may be a while, but we're going to bring him in. So he's coming in. He's going to work a WrestleMania match next year. I have no doubt about it. Maybe he'll even get his Hall of Fame induction next year. The Sting DVD is already being worked on. He's coming in. And I think and not only is he coming in, but Sting has done interviews this week to promote the video game and has outright said that he wants to come in. He has outright said that he wants one match with The Undertaker and then he wants to retire. He said this before. He's still harping on it. He says, I want to come in, I want to wrestle one match, WrestleMania next year sounds like a great place to do it, and I want it to be against The Undertaker. He said, I don't know if he's done or not, I don't think he is, and I really want that match with The Undertaker. So the question I pose to everybody listening, Sting's coming in, he's wrestling a match, he wants The Undertaker, maybe The Undertaker is done. Maybe WWE doesn't want to do that match. Maybe Vince knows something we don't, that's why he said, you know what, the streak is ending this year, no ifs, ands, or buts, it's done. He saw something we didn't, and he knows that Undertaker is done. I mean, who knows? But what Sting match intrigues you the most? I know a lot of people will say, well, no Sting match intrigues me. He's too old. He's going to be 56. He's broken down. I don't want to see him wrestle. Pretend like you don't have a choice. He is going to wrestle. I got a gun to your head, and you have to pick an opponent. What opponent would you prefer to see Sting in the ring with at WrestleMania? One last match next year. Is it Undertaker? Is that the biggest marquee match they could do with him? What about Triple H? You know, I'm listening to Triple H in that interview talk about Sting, and I'm getting a vibe here like that might be a possible match. If Undertaker isn't going to wrestle, maybe they could do Sting and Triple H. You know what? I wouldn't mind seeing that match. I think that match would have some marquee value to it. And that's a match that would at least allow Sting to go out a winner, because I think if Sting and Undertaker have a match, Undertaker needs to win that match. Undertaker needs to, if he's going to have one more match coming off that horrendous match with Brock and a loss, he deserves to end his career with a victory. I'm sure Sting would have no problem, you know, losing to The Undertaker. I mean, I've said this before. If you're going to do a Sting-Undertaker match, the story is right there. You know what I mean? Undertaker is done in his mind. He's finished. Sting says, not so fast. You've got one match left in you. It's going to be with me. Undertaker says, no, I'm not doing it. He cannot be convinced. Eventually, he is convinced under the provision that Sting agrees to this being both of their final matches. And you go into WrestleMania next year knowing that no matter what, you are witnessing the final Undertaker match ever, and you are witnessing the final Sting match ever. And that way, between that and the fact that the streak is over, so you don't have that, you know, monkey hanging over you anymore. You don't have that 800-pound elephant in the room. Well, you know, of course he's going to win. He's undefeated. Well, he's not undefeated anymore. Now you don't know so much whether or not he's going to win or lose. And so at least there's some element of what's going to happen. Are they both going to knock each other out and they're, you know, like a last man standing kind of double DQ thing, which I think would be stupid? No, I think Undertaker should go over and he should go out a winner. So is that the match you want to see? Do you want to see Sting and Triple H? Do you think that would be a better match? What about Sting and The Rock? There was one time many years ago, although this was a long time ago, like a decade, that Rock had floated the idea maybe of working a match with Sting at WrestleMania. Rock was always looking for big opponents to go up against. You know, there was a rumor that Rock had floated the idea of Randy Savage. Now, I don't know if Randy Savage physically would have even been able to do the match, and I don't think he realized how persona non grata Savage was with Vince McMahon at the time, but it never got that far because that would have been for WrestleMania 21, and that was a few months before is when Rock's contract expired. WWE forgot to extend it, and they just let his contract expire. And that was what caused the rift between Rock and Vince McMahon. He felt very offended by that. Like they were sending him a message. Like, you're not important anymore. And he went away for many, many years. And he never did wrestle at WrestleMania 21. But at one time, he was interested in doing a match with Sting. They could still do it. You know, Rock was doing interviews this week saying, yeah, I'd love to wrestle another match. I just have to find the right marquee opponent. Sting is not a mainstream name. Sting is not even as mainstream as John Cena is. So if Rock is looking for a mainstream name like a Brock or a Cena, it's not going to happen with Sting. Sting does not have that mainstream appeal. But for wrestling fans, I don't know. Is that a match that excites you? Sting and The Rock? What about Sting and John Cena? That would be a huge match. Cena would have to win. For all the people that John Cena has beaten and careers that have been stalled as a result, the idea that Sting would be the one to beat John Cena cleanly at WrestleMania just seems wrong to me. So Cena would have to win, and I'm sure that would just make people's heads explode. That would be a big match. What about Sting and a younger guy like Bray Wyatt? I think a Sting-Bray Wyatt match of all the new guys on the roster, the up-and-coming guys, he's the one that would make the most sense. People love to talk about dark characters and dark promos. I think that's what kind of brings people around to this idea of Undertaker and Sting. It's really the only common thing between them. I mean, they, at one time anyway, had these very dark characters and these dark entrances. And I guess you could say that both guys are kind of the franchise player of their respective company. Sting and Wyatt, kind of a similar thing, right? Wyatt comes out, he cuts these creepy promos. Sting hasn't really played the Crow character in a long, long time. He wasn't even the Crow in TNA. I don't care what face paint he was wearing. We have not seen Crow Sting, I'm going to say, probably since 1998. Because, what, you know, it became Wolfpack Sting, right, with the red face paint. I mean, Crow Sting really ended in 98. What is that, 15 years? That's a long time. Actually, probably 16 years by now. But I throw that out to you. If you had to make a choice, who would you prefer to see Sting against one last match at WrestleMania next year? Taker, Triple H, Rock, Cena, Wyatt, somebody else I'm not thinking of? I would think those are the biggest names you could do. Maybe there's somebody else. But you know, I'm looking forward to seeing him. I think even if he comes in, does the one match, and he hangs it up, I think you could keep him around as a character. I don't know what he would do. I don't really have any interest in reprising the GM character. I don't even think Sting should be on TV every single week. But he's done some of the best promo work of his career in the last few years in TNA. I mean, he was always good. You know, he's always good on the microphone. But I don't think I saw promos from this guy as good as what I saw from him in TNA when he was doing the Joker Sting character. It was incredible. And it doesn't matter how old you are, you can always grab a microphone and cut a promo. So Sting could be 60 years old, out there cutting promos better than 85% of the roster that they have now. I hope they find a role for him and can get him some TV time, because I think he can end up being a good character on the show, just not as an in-ring performer. We had Dean Ambrose getting beaten up backstage at the beginning of the show last Monday. I did like how after taking all that abuse, he just looks up and goes, "Is that all you got?" That was a key part of this whole thing, because we don't usually see that sort of thing. It just makes Ambrose seem crazy and makes him appear tough. Maybe even a little stupid, but unhinged. He was a badass here. That is until Seth Rollins squashed his head like a coconut with the curb stomp Meanwhile, John Cena and Roman Reigns, who were in the ring bickering before all this happened, they don't lift a finger to help the guy who was supposed to be their partner in the main event. Roman Reigns does nothing to save his supposed brother. He has learned well from John Cena. I mean, that attack was going on for a long time. They had plenty of time to leave the ring, save Ambrose, and they didn't because John Cena saves no one, not even his own girlfriend. Not even his own girlfriend when she has one arm tied behind her back. As John, one of our listeners, said on Twitter, why do people call him Superman when he never saves anybody? It's a fair point. One criticism, though, of Roman Reigns. I like his style of just how he carries himself and promos and all that kind of stuff. But Mike, and I think I mentioned this in the YouTube inbox that I did. I liked him coming out, telling John Cena, just get to the point. As John was rambling on, I wish more people would get to the point during their promos, but I guess then we'd only have a 45-minute show instead of 3 hours. The one criticism I have of Reigns is that he sometimes talks too low, to where I think it's hard for the people in the building to understand what he's saying. You know, I like the silent but deadly deal, but he's got to speak up a little bit more, especially when he's delivering a really great line. Like, a really great one-liner can just get completely lost if people don't hear it, if the crowd noise is kind of overwhelming what he's saying. I feel like sometimes that gets lost in that noise, and people end up not hearing him. Even on TV, it's sometimes hard to hear what he's saying. So I would just, at least during those key moments, I would speak up a little bit. Miz shocked the world with a roll-up win over Sheamus. Shocked the world for two reasons. Number one, Miz won a match. And number two, Sheamus is a guy who, even though he's lower on the card now, U.S. champion, he's not a main event player like he used to be, he's still very much protected. And so for Miz to get a pinfall win over Sheamus was pretty shocking. The new gimmick is they put Miz's giant freak head up on the Titantron during his matches. He also does everything in his power not to get hit in the face. So basically they've taken a key element of Tyler Breeze's gimmick down at NXT, and they've bestowed it upon The Miz. Just so stupid. Why handicap Breeze like that for the fucking Miz? He can't just do the basic Hollywood douchebag gimmick. I'm from Hollywood. I'm better than you. Is that not good enough? You've got to jack something from another guy's gimmick? I mean, it's been done before in wrestling. I mean, it's not like it's this brand new concept or anything like that. They built a whole match around somebody not getting hit in the face. Rick Martel, Shawn Michaels, SummerSlam 92. Sherry couldn't choose between them and said, oh, you know, I don't want either one of you to hit the other in the face. It's not like we haven't seen this before. The difference is that Tyler Breeze, that character, it's a character right now on NXT. He's doing the gimmick right now. And then you go and do this. It's such a waste. It's just such a waste. Word of the night on the show was moneymaker. They couldn't shut up with that frickin' word. Miz did not want to get hit in his moneymaker, we were told by the announcers about 1,000 times. If you would have started a drinking game from the first mention of the word moneymaker, you wouldn't be listening to this podcast right now because you would be dead. Dolph Ziggler beat Fandango, then got kissed after the match by both Summer Rae and Layla. So for one night at least, it was good to be Dolph Ziggler. Can't say that too often these days. We got some Sonic product placement comedy with Adam Rose and Damian Sandow. On SmackDown, I noticed somebody sent me a link to some more product placement. They said it was so awful, I had to watch it. And they had one that was even worse. Somehow, it was even worse with the Usos and Hornswoggle. They were supposedly enjoying their Sonic slushes, I guess they're called, even though they were clearly made of plastic. Okay, they were drinking plastic, basically. Get used to it, I guess. You know, this is what happens during budget cuts. We had a segment with Jack Swagger, Zeb, Rusev, and Lana. This was great. I thought this segment was great. The people reacted to it big time, especially when Rusev went for the kick. You know, it was basically a verbal confrontation back and forth between Lana, who's great in her role, and Zeb, who's always great. And then it got physical. After they agreed to a match at Battleground, it got physical. They went after each other. And the best part was Rusev going for that wicked kick that he's got, and Swagger grabs him and turns it into an ankle lock, and the place just went nuts. You've never seen people react to a frickin' Jack Swagger ankle lock like you did here. Again, I said it before. I hope they don't kill the gimmick off. There's no reason to. I don't think they will. Just tone down the Putin love and everything will be fine. And I said, you know, I'm watching this and I'm thinking to myself, because I thought Zeb was going to take a bump here. He kind of did, I guess. Lana slapped him, but I thought maybe Rusev was going to do something to the old guy. If Zeb could handle it, I think it would be great heat to have Rusev put him in the camel clutch after the match with Swagger on the pay-per-view. I mean, how much heat do you think that would get Rusev? If he put Zeb, okay, this grandfather, in the camel clutch right in the middle of the ring. Zeb still wrestles on occasion. As far as I know, he still wrestles here and there. A lot of people may not realize that he was a wrestler. I'm pretty sure he still does matches from time to time on the weekends. So if Rusev protects him on the move, I think the visual of him putting this old man in the camel clutch would be really effective, I think. Or maybe I'm just a sick fuck for wanting to see a grandfather broken in half. Anyway, Cameron and Alicia Fox beat Nikki Bella, still paying for the sins of her sister. This was a special night for Cameron as she got to team with her idol, one of her all-time great idols, Alicia Fox, of Melina vs. Alicia Fox fame, Cameron's all-time favorite wrestling match.
What's your favorite match?
My favorite match was with Melina and Alicia Fox.
Who?
Melina and Alicia Fox.
Out of all the matches in the history of this business, that was your favorite?
Like I said, this is something that I'm new to.
Any other favorite matches that I should know about?
Sorry, I can't name any.
Alicia pinned Nikki for the win. I'm sure Cameron immediately went back to her hotel to study the tape, watch the finish over and over again. Big E pinned Cesaro with the big ending. No Paul Heyman with Cesaro on this show. As we were told, there were rumors that Heyman had been fired, other rumors that he had quit. Michael Cole said, "You're both wrong. I saw him earlier in the day." And in fact, Cole was correct. Heyman was there. He showed up offering Triple H an option C if his plans for the WWE title did not go accordingly at Battleground. Meanwhile, Cesaro's losing streak continues. He may be winning the Intercontinental title, like I said earlier. Maybe that's the idea. He just loses and loses and loses, and then it's okay because he's going to win this secondary belt that means nothing. Maybe that's the logic. I still think Bo Dallas pulls it out and gets laid out by Barrett when he presents him with the belt. In the meantime, Cesaro is deader than dead right now. I guess, like I said earlier, they feel they can resuscitate him once they turn him babyface, and this will all be forgotten. And they're probably right. Once he starts swinging dudes again, the people will cheer. But it's still sad to see where he was 4 months ago and the reactions he was getting compared to now. And to see Jack Swagger getting the reactions that he's getting. It's like bizarro world. Chris Jericho cut a promo on the Wyatt family. He was interrupted by Bray Wyatt on the Titantron. Lights went out. Jericho was trapped by Harper and Rowan in the ring when they came back on. He managed to escape, only to get caught by Bray Wyatt in the aisleway, got laid out on stage with the sister Abigail. There were boring chants during Bray Wyatt's promo. The first time I've heard boring chants during a Bray Wyatt promo, which was quite unfortunate. I don't think it's indicative of any sort of larger trend. Again, it's the first time that people have reacted that way to him. Maybe it was, you know, just an isolated incident. Maybe they're tired of talking. They just want to see these two guys go head-to-head. They want action. I don't know. You know, it's only 1 week. We're going to have to wait until Raw this Monday and the following week and the week after that to see if this becomes a trend. I answered a question in the Sound Off inbox on YouTube. Are Bray Wyatt's promos overrated? Somebody asked me, and the answer is no. I don't think they are. I think he's one of the best promo guys in WWE. Sometimes what he's saying can go over my head, and it takes me a little while to understand it. But in the end, I understand what he's trying to say. It just makes you think. You know, his promos make you think a little bit more. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, there are some movies that people don't like because they're too sophisticated. I don't know what it means. It's too artsy. You know, but if you spend 5 fucking minutes trying to figure out what it means, you know, you're not stupid. It's not hard to figure out. You know, and so I like him. I appreciate him as a promo guy, and I wish more people would at least be allowed to put that sort of effort into what they say and into their promos. The one thing you could say about Bray Wyatt, I mean, I never get the impression that he's reading from a script or he's reading from cue cards. It sounds like it's ramblings that are coming from the mind of a madman. It's like he's living the gimmick. And I think that makes for some of the best pro wrestlers. You know, he seems like a genuinely creepy guy. You know, he did this kind of half-in-character, half-not-in-character interview with Brian Fritz, because he was at the NXT tapings, Bray, and he got interviewed by Brian Fritz. The interview's up on YouTube. It's a great interview. And, you know, he even said, listen, you know, I don't take stuff from them. You know, I come up with this stuff. It just comes from my mind. You know, I don't write it out and script it out. It's just, it's me. You know, it's me with the volume turned up a little bit. And that's just who he is. And I think that's what's missing in pro wrestling, man. We need more freaks. We need more weird people in pro wrestling. Not people playing a weird character, but like legitimately weird people. Okay? Dixie Carter doesn't count. I think we need more of that. So I don't think Bray's overrated at all. If anything, I think he might be underrated by some of those people who don't give him enough credit. So hopefully this was just an isolated incident. AJ Lee tapped out. Eva Marie with the Black Widow. Think about that. Eva Marie, who shockingly did not fuck anything up. This was not a horrible match, although it wasn't long either. So she didn't have a lot of time to mess things up. But think about that. Eva Marie is still under contract working for WWE at a time when they're doing budget cuts. And I'm sure a lot of that has to do with her being on Total Divas. But yet Ricky Steamboat, reports came out, was released recently by WWE due to budget cuts. He was still, he had a role down at NXT. He was a trainer. I don't think he could get in the ring and do physical stuff. They wouldn't allow it. If you remember that angle he did with the Nexus many years ago, I mean, at this point, I think it was probably 4 years ago, he took a real beating in that angle with the Nexus, and he had like a brain hemorrhage or something happened. He almost died. And so I don't think they let him physically get in the ring and train people. But he's been a trainer of sorts down in developmental for a long time, and now he's gone. They fired him. They got rid of him because of budget cuts, and yet Eva Marie still has a job. It seems very, very wrong to me. Paige was on commentary saying lovely things about AJ that she clearly did not believe. AJ then won the match, went outside, sat on top of the announce table, and grabbed the headset, and she said similarly wonderful things about Paige, like they were best friends. These two women clearly hate each other, and you could see right through their phony love for one another. This right here is what every woman thinks of each other, by the way. Okay, I'm telling you, ladies, you know I'm right. Bo Dallas beat Great Khali by countout, then tried to inspire him. Got a brain shot for his troubles. I thought it was odd that he didn't sell it as being dead. Every time we've seen Khali give somebody a brain shot, they lay there dead. It's like they're just killed dead right in the middle. And Bo didn't do that. He had this weird look on his face. You know, he was trying to sell it, but he just got up and kind of stumbled off. It's actually kind of like he no-sold the chop. Renee Young interviewed Ric Flair in the ring. Flair was kind of embarrassing out there, to be honest with you. I don't even know what the point of this segment really was. There was really no reason for him to be out there. I guess they just wanted to trot him out there. They were in Virginia. I guess that's kind of Flair country over there in that part of the country. And he got a big reaction when he came out. People love seeing him, but I just don't see what the point was in having him out there. She asked him who he thought would leave Battleground with the title. He predicted John Cena. I could have sworn that Flair endorsed Roman Reigns and The Shield on TV only a few months ago. Reigns came out, shook Flair's hand, which was a weird response, and Flair left. And on his way up the ramp, he encountered John Cena. John Cena was coming out for the main event. And John Cena handed Flair the World Heavyweight Championship belt, told him to hold on to it. Now, I didn't think much of it at the time. Now I'm reading reports online that that may have been the blow-off for the big gold belt. Or if it wasn't, that the plan is to get rid of that belt very soon. Maybe they'll present it as like an honorary title to Flair, either behind the scenes or on TV, I don't know. If that's the plan, I say good. Adios. The whole carrying two belts around thing was stupid anyway. It was stupid before. It's even dumber now. Especially Cena walks out there. He's like he's wearing a fucking scarf. You know, the way he connects those two belts together around his neck. You know, there should be one singular WWE title belt. You don't need two. Main event had John Cena and Roman Reigns winning by DQ over Randy Orton, Kane, and Seth Rollins after the heels beat up the babyfaces too much, and so the ref called for the DQ. One of the stupidest finishes in all of wrestling. second only to the distraction roll-up. Dean Ambrose never did make his way back out, so it was a handicap match. Rollins had gotten dumped out of the ring near the end, I guess, to get him out of the way, since he's not involved in the four-way at the pay-per-view. And it looked like he may have hurt his knee. Thankfully, he's just really good at what he does. And they sent the trainers over to him off-camera and everything just to make it look legit. But he was not hurt. He's not hurt in gutting through it. He was never hurt to begin with. There are still people who say, oh, he tweaked his knee, but he's going to keep wrestling. No, he didn't tweak anything. He's fine. He's just selling. Roman Reigns was the last man standing at the end of the show. And they sure did want to leave you with the impression that he's winning the title at the pay-per-view. Maybe he does. I would hold off for a little while longer, but I won't hate on putting the title on somebody different. I just happen to think that someone ends up being Seth Rollins, not Roman Reigns. NXT from this past Thursday, they can't all be winners. Even a great baseball player batting over 300 is going to swing and miss sometimes, and that's what happened with NXT this week. A lot of filler on the show. We opened with the Vaudevillains beating Enzo Amore and Colin Cassidy together as a tag team for the first time in something like 8 months after Sylvester Lefort and Marcus Louis walked out on stage for, I'll give you one guess, a fucking distraction roll-up finish. Is that not the laziest finish in the history of wrestling? I could leave it, like, once in a while, if you do it, that's fine. I'm not saying never, ever do it. But when you do it on every show, every single week, and now even on the developmental show you're doing it, it's just fucking lazy. For the love of God, please stop with the distraction roll-ups. Enough. And it sucks that Enzo and Kaz lost too, because I was kind of hoping they would start building them for the Ascension. The Ascension has not really had any serious contenders for the titles, maybe ever, throughout their entire reign. That's the only appealing match I really see for them, maybe, is building something with the Ascension against Kaz and Enzo. Although, the way they're kind of building the Ascension now, and they had a promo later in the show where they actually spoke like normal people, it seems like they're being positioned as babyfaces. Kaz and Enzo were babyfaces. Maybe that's a match they just don't want to do. But to me, that's the only really appealing match for them. But instead, it looks like they're continuing this feud with the Frenchman, which I just find boring as hell. CJ Parker, speaking of boring as hell, beat Xavier Woods with what appeared to be a botched pinfall. He had him rolled up, and I think he was supposed to grab onto the ropes for added leverage, but things just got really sloppy. He kind of fell over, and he reached for the ropes while the ref was counting the pin, but again, he was kind of falling over at the same time, couldn't even reach the ropes. It just looked bad. Match itself was fine, but I can't get into a CJ Parker Xavier Woods match. Not after the way they booked Woods on the main roster. I just can't do it. The Boss, Sasha Banks, beat Alexa Bliss. Good match. Great finish. Sasha gave her a backstabber and immediately rolled over right into a crossface. And when I say she put this girl in a crossface, now, Alexa Bliss is tiny. She's like 5 feet tall. She's a tiny, tiny girl. And Sasha Banks cranked back on this girl's neck. I thought she was going to rip her head off. Blood was going to start spurting out. It was going to be like a fatality in a Mortal Kombat game. It looked brutal, and Bliss had no choice but to tap. Another Diva submission hold that looks more painful than the ones from the male guys on the roster. Just show them how it's done, ladies, I guess. Tyler Breeze, backstage interview with Devin Taylor. He said his finger is healing. His lawyers are in the process of drawing up the contract for his eventual NXT title match with Adrian Neville. Still won't tell us when that will be. Instead, he showed us his new music video again, which made me very happy. Best thing on the show up to this point. Adam Rose beat Jason Jordan with the party foul. He's still over on NXT, Rose is. I'll give him that. Jordan landed right on top of his head when he took that party foul move. It looked great, but he's lucky he didn't break his neck. Jordan also did an inset promo before the match. He mentioned that his partner, Ty Dillinger, is out with an injury. Ty Dillinger is the former Shawn Spears. You may remember him from the WWE version of ECW. I think he had a cup of coffee there. He was gone for a while. They brought him back many months ago to developmental, so Ty Dillinger is his new name. They had one match on NXT several weeks ago, and I thought they had some real potential I really did. It was just, it was Dillinger and Jordan against another kind of no-name team. But I got into the match because I liked Jordan and Dillinger as a team. I just thought they worked really well together. And here he is in this promo saying that he's out hurt. I hope it's not true. Maybe it's just part of a storyline. I really hope it's not true because I thought they had great potential as a team. All it takes is one injury. If the guy's out for a while, their team is going to be forgotten about. I can guarantee it. And here, for Jordan, it doesn't really work out too well for him either because in this match, he really was nothing more than a punching bag for Adam Rose. Kalisto was interviewed by Devin Taylor backstage. He said that he and El Local had agreed to mutually part ways, which is not surprising after Ricardo's performance at NXT TakeOver. I like Ricardo, but he just wasn't very good on that show. He had a bad night. And so Kalisto said that he would pick a new tag team partner for his match with the Vaudevillains next week. Main event was Sami Zayn beating Tyson Kidd. Real good match. He beat him by submission with the Koji Clutch. I like that about Sami. Again, he's got a collection of different moves that he can go to. That was one of the things I liked when Sheamus first came in. Remember when Sheamus first came in? He had like three or four solid moves, one of which was the Razor's Edge, which they had him stop doing, I guess, because guys were landing on the back of their head and getting concussed or possibly concussed. But he had that, which I think they called the Celtic Cross. He had the Bro Kick. He had the White Noise. There was something else. I like guys that have like four or five different moves they can go to. It's not just the same finish all the time. Sami Zayn has a collection of a few different moves, one of which is the Blue Thunder Bomb. Have I mentioned this? Have I mentioned that I love the Blue Thunder Bomb? Because I do. He never wins with it, but it's awesome. A much-needed win here for Sami Zayn, who also kicked out of Tyson Kidd's Blockbuster, which is his finish off the top rope. So they had a really good match. And, Tyson Kidd, I have to say, they're doing this story with him. It's been this evolution of Tyson Kidd from whatever the hell he was before, a man without any sort of direction, this just meandering babyface that had nothing going for him, to clearly a heel, even if he doesn't think it, and the drama they're building with him and his wife, Natalia, and he goes out there and they chant Natty's husband at him and it drives him nuts. I like what they've been doing with Tyson Kidd. I mean, he's really turned into an interesting character on the show. And I hope he sticks around, I hope he does. I kind of thought that at some point, maybe they could still do this, that at some point the payoff here is not going to be marital problems that result in some sort of breakup with him and Natalia. I sure hope not, because when they've done that, if you go back in wrestling history and couples, like boyfriend, girlfriend, husband, wife, who have been involved in some kind of storyline that ends up with the two of them breaking up or turning on the other, it usually mirrors itself in real life. So for Tyson's sake, I hope that's not the direction this is going in. Maybe in the end, though, if they can figure out a way to get there, it turns out to be like a big ruse. And, Natalia, it's actually a deal where she's kind of been with him the whole time, and they've had this plan to trick people into thinking there's been problems between them, but then Tyson has a big match, and she kind of helps him out, and they were together all along, we're all fools, that kind of thing. I guess it kind of wouldn't make sense just because Tyson had that title rematch with Adrian Neville all those weeks ago, and I think it was in that match, either the first match or the second match, that Natalia prevented him from using a chair. She told her husband, oh, you're better than that, you don't need this. So I guess it kind of wouldn't make sense, but that at least would make things intriguing. If Natalia turned heel with Tyson and they were just heels on NXT and she was a babyface everywhere else, it's kind of like Bret Hart during the Canadian angle they did in 97, Canada versus the U.S., where he was a heel in the United States, but in Canada and everywhere else, he was this beloved babyface. This obviously is on a much smaller level, but maybe they can pull something off with Tyson and Natalia at some point if they've got an end point here for this gimmick. But that was NXT. Not the best episode. I was really not impressed by much this week. The main event was good. The Tyler Breeze video, that's always fun to watch, but we've seen it before. Everything else just felt like filler. It really did. There was no real forward movement on this show. It was just kind of boring in a lot of spots. So this was a miss. Hopefully they have a rebound next week. Thank you guys for taking time out of your day to listen to The Sound Off. I get questions from people asking, how can I support the podcast? Well, the best way to support the show is simple. Just keep listening each and every week. Keep spreading the word about it to friends and family and retweet or share links to the episodes on Twitter and Facebook. But beyond that, you can contribute by making a PayPal donation or by signing up for a free 30-day trial of the Audible.com service. Making a PayPal donation is simple. Just log on to thesolemonster.com and you'll see the PayPal donation box on the right-hand side of the page. Enter whatever amount you'd like and click the Make a Donation button. That's it. Or sign up for a free Audible trial by entering our custom URL, audibletrial.com/solemonster. From there, you can sign up free for 30 days, which helps us out. You get one free audiobook as part of your trial that you get to keep no matter what. You can browse through their library of over 150,000 titles. Listen to your books at home, on the commute to work, at the gym, whenever, wherever. Sign up at audibletrial.com/solemonster or visit thesolemonster.com to make a donation right now. And thank you for supporting The Sound Off. Time for the TNA report. TNA is promising a big announcement later today as I am recording this, so it probably will not happen until after the show is already over. I don't know what it is. They use the TNA NYC hashtag in the tweet that they sent out from the official Impact Wrestling account, so it may be another gimmick show at one of the tapings next month when they come back to New York City. I'll be in attendance at the first night of tapings on August 5th, and TNA announced this week that will be the Hardcore Justice show that they're taping, which will include the Six Sides of Steel. I would think this is where they're also going to be doing the Stairway to Janus match between Bram and Abyss that they set up at the tapings that I went to last month. So if that, I guess that hasn't aired yet, so oops, spoiler alert. They had a Monsters Ball match on the show that I went to, and they just tore the shit out of each other with barbed wire and thumbtacks. I mean, it was brutal. So this time, Janus is going to be hanging from the ceiling, and the first person to pull it down can use it as a weapon. People who don't watch TNA are listening to this right now, and they're probably wondering, who the fuck is Janus, and why are they hanging her from the ceiling? Janus is a giant board with nails coming out of it that belongs to Abyss, although it is named after Dixie Carter's mother, Janus, I guess, as a rib. So yeah, lucky me, I get to go see ladders and tacks and nails and fire and all that lovely stuff. Or, as we in New York call it, another Tuesday night. So, as far as this big TNA announcement, it could be another gimmick show, maybe at the next night of tapings. I had heard that TNA was going to be making some sort of announcement about their TV deal to the wrestlers, I guess, backstage when they get to New York City for the next set of tapings. Maybe this announcement has something to do with a renewal with Spike TV. I don't, for their sake, I hope so, but I don't know. What I do want to lead off with, though, before we get into the review of the first New York City taping that aired this week, is, unfortunately, another TNA base brawl embarrassment. This time on Friday night in Louisville, Kentucky, it looked like a couple of hundred people in the crowd at the most, and that's probably being generous. TNA had another baseball stadium show outdoors. There had been bad weather in the area during the day, I'm told, but you know what? Bad weather did not chase away 500 people or 1,000 people. We've seen images from these stadium shows before, and I said it once, I'll say it again. If TNA cannot promote these shows properly, they need to stop doing them. I've been to base brawl shows of theirs before. In fact, they brought, I think, four or five here to the stadium in Brooklyn. At MCU Park, where the Brooklyn Cyclones play, I've been to every single one of those shows, and I always had fun. I always had a good time. Again, they did that show at that stadium year after year over here in Brooklyn before Ring of Honor took their spot this year. And I always had fun, but there also were actual people in the stands, you know, but this is New York. So I think people are more in tune with, you know, when an event comes to the area, is TNA coming to town? Is ROH coming? Is WWE coming? What's going on? It's New York, and also I can tell you that the Cyclones baseball team does a good job of promoting events at their ballpark. It's not just TNA doing promoting, it's the Cyclones as well. They go hand in hand. So it's not really a surprise to me that for all of those baseball shows, they were able to get a few thousand people in the stadium. They never quite got as many people as they did for the first show in Brooklyn at the ball field. That very first show that I went to had, I think, 5,500, which at that time had been their biggest domestic attendance for any event, I think, in their history. And every single summer since then, for the other three or four that they did, the number progressively went further down and down and down. But they still had, you know, 2,000-3,000 people, I would say, at least in the ballpark. But that's New York. It's just shameful how they send those guys out there to perform in front of a bunch of empty seats. And then you have people who live there who say, TNA was in town. Oh, I would have gone, but I had no idea. How is it possible that TNA comes to these cities, or these little towns in some cases, a promotion with national TV, and wrestling fans don't know about it? How does that happen? It's just, it's inexcusable. And I think it's got to be demoralizing for the wrestlers. So they got to get their shit together on those baseball shows, because it's just, it's a running joke at this point, but it's sad. You know, it's like people are just waiting for those images of the 15 people sitting in the crowd so they can point and mock TNA. I'm not mocking TNA. I'm taking them to task for not promoting their shit properly. And if they're going to keep doing these shows, it's just embarrassing. It becomes a black eye for your company. Why do you keep doing that to yourself? Don't do the shows if you don't have the budget or you don't have the manpower to promote them properly. People would go to these shows if they knew about them. I'm not saying that they would have had 5,000 people in that ballpark, but you can't tell me that if TNA comes to town and you promote the shit out of that show, and they've got some big names, they've got Jeff Hardy. Yeah, these are names that people should know from WWE, even if they've never seen a TNA show before. You can't tell me that you can't pack 700 or 800 people or 1,000 people or more into that ballpark. If local indie promotions can pack that many people, then why can't TNA? It's not the wrestler's fault. There's something else going on here, and they got to get their shit together and fix that. So Thursday night, it was the return of the six-sided ring. I can't say that it ruined my enjoyment of the show. It didn't enhance my enjoyment of the show. It's a fucking ring that has two extra sides. I don't see the big deal. I hope for the sake of the wrestlers that it doesn't, hurt their bodies anymore. Maybe they soften the mat or whatever. I know that was one of the big knocks on the ring from some of the TNA guys back in the day, that working in that ring, I guess because the ropes maybe are more tightly wound and everything is just, it's smaller, it's tighter, and it was harder on your body. Maybe they tweaked it to make it a little bit easier on the anatomy. I don't know. For the wrestler's sake, I hope so. But to me, four sides, six sides, it doesn't mean shit. The only thing that matters is, what kind of show are you putting on? Am I bored or am I interested in the show? And I thought that this was a good show. I thought it was a solid effort. It's only the first taping. They taped six shows in New York City the first time. Again, they're going to be going back in a couple of weeks for another six. So this was only the first taping. It kept up TNA's string of good shows that they've had on TV the last few weeks. Didn't blow me away or anything like that. I think the tapings get better as they go on. They have the Destination X show coming up in a week or so, which I'm sure is going to be great. The shows that I went to were pretty good, probably even better than this. So for a first effort, we got some good wrestling. We got less in the way of stupid backstage skits, so I would say that's a plus. The main event was also really good. I really would say that if you're not a TNA watcher, or if you are, but you've gotten kind of lazy with keeping up with the show, it's worth going out of your way to find on YouTube or wherever the Lashley-Jeff Hardy main event. They had a good match, although it wasn't actually the main event. I'll get to that later in my review. Kurt Angle opened the show. He welcomed us. He was up in the balcony showing off the return of the six-sided ring. And, you know, it's funny, like, having him up in the balcony like that, just in the middle of the fans, and he was wearing his suit, and you saw the ring kind of in the background. He looked like, I don't know, like Nick Cannon hosting America's Got Talent, just like a game show host or something. Taz then appeared in the balcony on the opposite side. He kind of came out of nowhere. Why he was in the balcony, I have no idea. But there he was, and he cut a promo that ended with some of his old ECW catchphrases, win if you can, survive if I let you. A lot of ex-ECW fans here in New York, they ate it up. And with that, out came Bully Ray and Tommy Dreamer. Boy, if you were a fan of ECW, then I guess this was the perfect open to this show. But to me, it was at that point, after the Taz promo, and then here comes Bully, and here comes Dreamer, it felt like another ECW reunion show in just the first few minutes. And that's not the vibe this show should have. You know, how many times can we go back to the ECW nostalgia? You know what I mean? It's like, Bully is one of the top stars in TNA. I'm not saying don't put Bully Ray on the show. I just think having Taz cut the promo he did, and none of them ever mentioned the initials ECW, but they clearly mentioned it. Taz talked about this revolution that he was part of, and then, you know, it just so happens that the first segment out comes Dreamer and Bully. It just, I'm looking at this going, God, you know, this is not what they need to be doing. Maybe the audience there in New York loved it, but as a fan watching on TV, can we please get away from the ECW nostalgia? Please, why not open the show with, you know, Austin Aries in a great match, or like showcase something unique about TNA, like the original TNA talent in that first match. This is supposed to be like turning a new leaf for this company. This was like almost like a TNA reboot with these New York tapings. I feel like they should have opened the show not with a promo, not with, you know, nostalgia. They should have opened the show with a solid like 15-minute awesome balls to the wall match, maybe for the X title or something like that. But out came Bully, out came Dreamer. Tommy Dreamer appeared to have his Twitter handle written down the side of his left leg, which means that Tommy Dreamer is better at promoting himself than TNA is at promoting itself. EC3 and Rhino came out. They were the opponents. EC3 was awesome here. He was on the mic on his way to the ring. The fans started chanting, "You can't wrestle." And he said, "Yes, I can." They said, "You can't wrestle." He said, what did he say? "Very good" or something. This went on for a while. He was great. He has really grown into the role. I've become a big EC3 fan. I've said this even before this show. He and Rhino beat Bully and Dreamer when Ethan rolled up Dreamer for the pin off of a distraction from Rockstar Spud. But like I said, EC3 was the highlight of this segment for me. Great on the mic. The dude's been winning me over. It makes you wonder how many guys like him WWE is missing out on because they just won't give them a chance. They don't see them as being worthy of their time, I guess, and that's why they cut Derek Bateman. That's all he was. He was Derek Bateman, the comedy guy from NXT, and here he is making a name for himself in TNA. They're actually giving this guy a push. They've created a star here, and it makes you wonder how many more people like him are still working for WWE, and they're just kind of floundering, and they're not doing anything with them. At least TNA gave the guy a chance, and he's making the most of it. There were backstage segments on this show with James Storm and Sonata. They've been doing an angle where James Storm, I don't know if he's taken a liking to Sonata, if he sees something in him, but he'll come across him or he'll go over to him backstage and just browbeat him and talk crap to him, I guess, as a way to maybe motivate him. So they did some of that before Sonata went out for the next match. Austin Aries won a Royal Rumble-style 8-man X Division Championship Gauntlet match, that was a mouthful, to retain the X Division title, which means that Austin Aries heads into Destination X either to defend the title or to cash it in for Option C and trade the title in for a shot at Bobby Lashley's TNA World Heavyweight Championship. Start to finish, this went over 15 minutes, so they gave it time. This is probably what should have opened the show, in all honesty. And they did something similar to what WWE should have considered doing for their Intercontinental Battle Royal tonight, where the final two men ended up in a singles match, and that was Austin Aries and Sonata. Other participants in the match were Manic, DJ Zima, Crazy Steve, who had no business being in there, Tigre Uno, Davey Richards, and Eddie Edwards. Eddie Edwards started the Battle Royal out with Aries, which resulted in loud ROH chants. I would imagine, you know, I felt the same way, to be honest with you, when I went to the tapings a few days after this, and, I don't want to give any spoilers about some of the specific matches, but you have guys on the show like The Wolves, and Aries, and Samoa Joe, and just being up in that grand ballroom upstairs in the Manhattan Center, which is where a lot of those early ROH shows that I went to were. They were all upstairs in the ballroom before they moved downstairs to the Hammerstein. And it really did. It felt like I was at an ROH show, and the fans were chanting ROH. Apparently, they're not going to edit them out, because you heard the ROH chants here on the show. Of all the editing that they did, and they did quite a bit of editing on the show that I wasn't thrilled with, but they left that in, so that was kind of weird. Sonata and Aries, they shook hands when the match was over. Again, Aries got the win, but that handshake did not sit well with James Storm. The fact that Sonata lost yet another match, so We got a segment afterwards where Sonata's backstage and James Storm goes up to him and just beats the snot out of Sonata, keeps yelling at him, calling him a loser, beating the crap out of him, leaves him laying in a heap. And we also learned that the great Muda will be appearing on next week's Impact, so I think between the stuff with Storm and Sonata, and Storm also would bring up Muda and say, you know, you're disappointing him and all this other stuff, I would smell a turn coming for Sonata if I know my wrestling. We got a quick Jeff Hardy promo in the back saying that Willow was created to deal with the darkness that came over TNA, but thanks to Kurt Angle, Jeff Hardy is back. Here's another idea. The next time darkness rains down upon TNA, crack open a fucking window. That way you'll get plenty of light and you can spare us the alter ego nonsense. MVP said he was wrestling this next match under protest because he's still suffering from a torn meniscus in his knee, which is a legit injury, although it seems like they're playing it up as a fake injury on TV, but it's not. It was MVP and Kenny King against Bobby Roode and Eric Young. I don't know why they're letting MVP in the ring at all with an injury like that. He didn't do anything, really, in this match. He's still clearly hurt. At least when they taped these shows, he was still hurt. Heels beat the babyfaces down with a pair of crutches for the DQ. Madison Rayne beat Brittany in a no DQ, no countout match. Crowd was so interested in this, they started a loud Christy Hemme chant. I don't blame them. I was at these tapings, and I saw Christy up close. Okay, I was in the front row, and I saw Christy up close. She is smoking hot. So, chant Christy Hemme all you want to. I really can't argue with that. Madison won with what Mike Tenay called a package DDT, but I don't think that's really an accurate description of what it was, since she landed on her ass. But, since I don't have one better, we'll go with package DDT. Main event match was Lashley defeating Jeff Hardy with a spear to retain the TNA World Heavyweight Championship. A really good match with one insanely stupid bump from Jeff Hardy. This guy's going to kill himself. I mean, if that's what he wants to do, so be it. But they did a spot where Jeff laid Lashley out on the steel ring steps outside the ring. And it looked like there was like an added layer of steel or plastic, aluminum, whatever the hell it was, on top of the stairs. But it was still the steel steps. And Jeff Hardy climbs back into the ring, up to the top rope, and does a Swanton Bomb, which, of course, Bobby Lashley moves out of the way. And Jeff Hardy lands right on top of the ring steps with the Swanton Bomb. It was just, ugh. The guy's going to kill himself. That's all I got to say. And it was a spectacular bump, but, you know, he shouldn't be doing that. He really should not be doing that. He was pretty much done for after that. Got back in the ring. That's when Lashley speared him. 1-2-3. So a convincing win for Lashley. You know, it's funny, they're booking Bobby Lashley as champion a hell of a lot better than they ever did Magnus when he was champion, better than Eric Young when he was champion. Lashley is a heel, but he's a monster. He doesn't need help, and he didn't get any help. There was no interference in this match from Kenny King, from MVP. He didn't hold the ropes, he didn't hook the tights, he didn't throw powder in his eyes. Jeff Hardy made one stupid mistake, and he paid the price for it, and Bobby Lashley got the clean win, which... he's gotten plenty of clean wins recently over Eric Young, okay? That's how you book your world champion. And that was the biggest problem I had with Magnus as the champ. Yes, he was the heel, but so is Lashley. And guess what? They're booking him to be a credible world champion. Lashley, or Magnus was champion for what, 4 months? He was a fucking pussy. Every single week he was booked to be a pussy. A-plus promos, but once he got in the ring, the matches were only okay. And the finishes, I mean, it just made him look like a complete puss. So he was a failure as a world champion. You can't take somebody like that seriously. Eric Young, they tried, but he's been a comedy character for so long, nobody ever really saw him as a world champion. And if he got over like one, he'd still have the belt. They put the belt on Lashley. The guy's a monster. I saw him in... I mean, he is so... I can't even describe to you how enormous in person this guy is. He was standing 5 feet in front of me, and just a shadow was cast over the first three rows. I mean, he is a gigantic man. He's not a bad wrestler. You know, he used to bore me, but I'm kind of getting into him as champion. I think it's the right role for him. I hope they keep the title on him for a while. I know he signed for a fight with Bellator. I think it's a little crazy to put him in an MMA fight. I don't care who you pick for him. If you pick some you know, schlub, anybody can beat anybody in a mixed martial arts match at any given moment on any given day. All it takes is Bobby Lashley, your monster heel TNA World Heavyweight Champion, to get knocked out or lose a fight to a guy with a losing record, some kind of scrub. That would be really, really bad if that happened. So maybe they find a way to get the belt off Lashley before that fight. I think the fight is at the beginning of September. Maybe he loses the title at the next New York City taping, since those tapings are going to carry them through September. I hope not, though. I think it would be a mistake. I think you keep the belt on him for a while until you have a strong enough babyface to come along and beat him for it. I don't know if Bobby Roode is that guy. I don't know if Bully Ray is that guy. But I'm okay with Lashley being the champion. I said it the night that he won the belt when he beat Eric Young. I don't have a problem with Bobby Lashley being the champion. And to my surprise, they've really built him up as a very strong, credible champion. And I applaud them for that. The unfortunate part about this is that this match would have been a fine way to end the show, but nope, we weren't done yet, because Delusional Dixie had not yet made her grand appearance. And so the show continued. Backstage, a pissed off Kurt Angle told MVP that he is wrestling a singles match next week against Bobby Roode. It'll be false count anywhere. MVP was not happy with that development. And then came the real main event of the show, which was Rockstar Spud introducing Madame Dixie, who came out with EC3. She bad-mouthed New Yorkers. Not surprising, given how her devout loyalty to one New Yorker for so many years basically helped cripple her company. She referred to Bully Ray as a C-rated star. Well, B-plus player was taken, I suppose. Bully and Dreamer came out with a table bearing Dixie's name. They cleared the ring of all the heels. They were about to put Dixie through the table when EC3 gave Dreamer a low blow. Dixie escaped through the crowd. We then heard familiar music as D-Von returned to TNA. He and Bully delivered the WhatsApp to EC3. Then D-Von pulled out a table. They put EC3 through it with the 3D. Crowd was happy to see D-Von, and that's how we went off the air. It irritated me that they did not go off the air with the title match, as good as it was. Plus, it's a world championship match. You know, you're in New York City. How do you, you know, and it's a big match, too. Bobby Lashley, Jeff Hardy, two of your biggest stars. How do you not end the show with that? You know, I mean, but that's TNA's MO. I guess they wanted the feel-good moment with D-Von's return at the end, and Lashley winning wasn't feel-good enough for them, but it still should have ended the show. There's no reason this segment that we saw here with the Dixie nonsense could not have opened the second hour of the show. It should not have ended the show. But a good show overall, and I think the tapings do get better as they go along, and get used to it, because these New York City shows are going to be Impact's home that you see on TV for the next 2 months at least, with so many shows they've taped. I like the atmosphere. I like the way that it came across. I mean, it looks kind of small, but you know what? It's better than putting Impact in a building that's bigger, but only filling half of it, because then that looks even more depressing. So you had a bunch of rowdy fans who are into the show and having a good time, and it's a different setting, and it just looks different. It's fresh. I don't know if it'll still feel as fresh 2 months from now, but right now it does, so I like that aspect of it. One more thing on the TNA front before we move on here. I have to comment on this, and it involves Vince Russo. Now, there had been a lot of discussion in recent months about whether or not Vince Russo is still working for TNA. He would deny it. A lot of people in TNA would deny it. It was Mike Johnson of PWInsider.com a few months ago, actually, who broke the story. Him and Dave Scherer, who work over on that website, who said they have it on reliable intel, I guess you would say, that Vince Russo is, in fact, still under contract in some capacity and working for TNA, whether it's in a creative role or some other role. He is still connected to TNA. He is not gone. And TNA did not want that to get out. In fact, after this debacle that unfolded this week, which I'll get into in a second, Russo even said that it was his employer. It was TNA who did not want word getting out. It was supposed to be confidential. Now, let me ask you this. Why do you think TNA would not want news of Vince Russo working for their company to get out? If Vince Russo is such a sought-after commodity in wrestling, and he is such an integral part of the TNA machine, and he's so great at what he does. And he's such a welcome addition to the roster in that company behind the scenes. Why would they go through the trouble of keeping it a secret? I'll tell you why. Because they don't want to be embarrassed. And also, there was some talk that the folks over in Japan, because TNA has a working agreement with Wrestle One and the Great Muta, and word had come down, supposedly from the Japanese side, that if they found out Vince Russo was working in TNA again, they weren't going to be doing business with TNA. Because they do not like Vince Russo. They think he's a racist. They think, you know, if you go back in time, all the Japanese talent they had in TNA, Okada, Kazuchika Okada, one of the biggest stars in wrestling right now in New Japan, former IWGP heavyweight champion, he was in TNA before he hit it big in New Japan. So was Hiroshi Tanahashi, two of the biggest stars in all of wrestling in the last decade. TNA had them first, and they were nothing but comedy fodder on that show. And WWE is no better, but the Wrestle One folks never forgot that. They didn't want to have anything to do with Russo, and supposedly they were assured he has nothing to do with this, he has no power anymore, he's not writing the shows, the buck stops with somebody else now, don't worry about it, and that put their mind at ease. But I find it funny, you know, that Russo, you know, he's so horribly, unfairly bashed and criticized by people, and people just don't understand. They have the wrong impression of him. And yet, TNA apparently went through painstaking troubles to make it very clear to him that he is not to tell anybody that he works for them, and nobody was to find out about it, and if they do, just deny it. You know, what a great guy that they went through such trouble to hide this. But what happened this week, and the reason I bring Russo's name up, is there was a little incident that took place. Mike Johnson, over at PW Insider, received an email. He was copied on an email that Vince Russo himself was sending to Mike Tenay and Taz with instructions on how to handle the commentary and post-production for these New York City shows, because Tenay and Taz, I guess, were in Nashville to do the voiceovers and whatnot. And so Russo was sending them instructions as per his deal, because in fact Vince Russo was still working, and maybe still is, still working in some capacity for TNA. How involved he is, I don't know, but he is or was still under contract to them. Somehow, Mike Johnson of PW Insider got copied on that email. How the hell that happens, I don't even know. Johnson gets the email, and that's confirmation. After months of denials and speculation on their original report, they now have irrefutable proof that, in fact, Vince Russo is working for TNA. So they put a news item on their website explaining that Mike Johnson was inadvertently copied on this email from Vince Russo, and so that should put to rest any debate whatsoever that Vince Russo is, in fact, back under the employ of TNA. That's all that it was. It was just a brief confirmation on the PW Insider site that their original report was accurate. They didn't reprint the email. They didn't bash Russo. They were just stating what happened. So what followed is so freaking embarrassing. It is so, it's so Vince Russo in a lot of ways. He goes on Twitter, Russo does, and he bashes PW Insider. How does he bash PW Insider and Mike Johnson? He drags their name through the mud by going on Twitter and claiming, "Swerve! I swerve them! This just proves that these so-called wrestling journalists will print anything. They don't check things out. They'll just, you send it to them and they'll print it like it's fact. I intentionally copied him on this phony email pretending that I'm still working for TNA, and he ran with it, and I swerved him." And he just went on and on and on. He said, "The swerve still works." And he says, you know, "Since an unreliable website has brought me so much free promotion, feel free to check out my website." Then he sent an email to Mike Johnson directly, or a tweet, I should say. He says, "Would you thank Dave Scherer, who also works on PW Insider, would you thank Dave for me for all the free promotion? If I knew it was going to be this easy, I would have done this a long time ago." Just so embarrassing. And Mike Johnson stuck to his guns. He said, "This is not a swerve. He's trying to save face. I have the email. I can reprint the email if you want me to. The ball's in your court." So basically, he threw it right back in Russo's face and said, "Listen, I can print the email and show people if you want me to. You've got two choices. You either come clean and admit your mistake, or I can just show them, you know, everybody the proof and let them make up their own minds. So the end result of all this was that Russo had to walk back all of his statements. He had a public apology that he issued to Mike Johnson. Supposedly, he also reached out to him privately and emailed him a private apology. Now, all of these tweets were up on Russo's timeline. For whatever reason, he removed the public apology. He took it down. I don't know if he had second thoughts, you know, about actually taking responsibility for his actions. I've talked about this on the show before. That's not something that Vince Russo has done much of in the past, is take responsibility for his own words and his own actions. And finally, he did so because he was up against the wall, and then he took down all the tweets, so that's kind of funny. All this does to me is, you know, I told you people, the dude is a slime ball. He's a slime ball. That's all he is. I don't care if he's a Christian, he's a born-again Christian, we all make mistakes. What he did here is an embarrassment. He took a guy, Mike Johnson, and dragged his name and his reputation, his website, that's his business. He dragged the guy's name and rep through the mud, knowing full well he was not telling the truth. That he, himself, Russo, was not telling the truth. He knew that, and he made a decision to embarrass the guy for no good reason. You know what that's like? That's like Ryan Braun, okay, that other scumbag in Major League Baseball, who got busted for performance-enhancing drugs, and he denied it, and they had proof. I think he got off on a technicality, whatever happened. But in the end, it was proved that, in fact, he did take stuff that he shouldn't have taken. He ended up admitting, you know, his guilt, but not before he dragged the name of the tester who had collected the original samples, and I think he said they were tampered with or something. He dragged that guy's name and reputation through the mud. I don't even think he ever apologized to that guy. But he knew he was lying. He knew he was full of shit. He dragged that guy's name through the mud, threw him under the fucking bus to cover his own ass, and in the end, he got caught anyway. That's kind of what happened here. You know, how can you respect somebody like that? And Russo's response to all of this after apologizing for what he did was to say that, you know, he had to keep confidential his arrangement with TNA. It was his employer. His employer wanted it to be kept confidential. And so I wanted to honor their wishes. And that's what I intended to do. He said, my integrity means everything to me, so I just hope you can understand and forgive. My integrity means everything to me. See, the implication there is that you have any integrity in the first place, which is a joke. If this news gets out, and you didn't leak it yourself, but it gets out somehow that Vince Russo was working or probably working for TNA, and that's not what TNA wanted, okay, they didn't want that news to get out, but you didn't leak it yourself, so your response is to knowingly drag somebody's name through the mud. How about keeping your fucking mouth shut and not saying anything? No, instead, he chose to knowingly go out and smear somebody else knowing that he himself was full of shit. And I'm happy now that it's out in the open. I mean, it's the worst-kept secret in wrestling that Vince Russo was still working in some capacity for TNA. Now we know for sure. And Russo handled it, I guess, the only way that Vince Russo could handle it. He tried to turn it into a swerve, and in the end, it blew up in his face and made him look like a jackass. Let's move on to the mailbag. After this, we will do a sound-off throwback to an episode from 1 year ago, and then I have some thoughts on CM Punk's official departure from WWE. I'll save that for the end of the show. If you have questions for the mailbag, though, email them to me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from. We have an audio question this week, and this comes to us from Steve in Dover, England.
Hey there, Solomonster. Steve here. I was wondering what you thought about the old format of NXT, back when there was 8 rookies competing for a place on the main roster. I know I really enjoyed the concept, so I was wondering what your thoughts were on the subject.
I was a fan of the original NXT concept when it first started, and they were matching guys up with pros. I thought it was so funny how they matched up The Miz as a pro for Bryan Danielson, who then became Daniel Bryan. It just was hilarious to me. But you look back on what they were doing with Bryan back then, Bryan was clearly positioned as the top star for that first season of NXT. They used Michael Cole as a way to help get him over. Bryan was featured in a lot of... Some of the more memorable segments from that first season involved Daniel Bryan and Michael Cole, or Daniel Bryan and The Miz. And I think the very first episode of that first NXT season had a main event of Daniel Bryan against Chris Jericho in his first WWE match. And Jericho may have actually been the World Heavyweight Champion at that time. So they clearly saw Bryan as the star of the show, even though Barrett ended up going on to win. So yeah, at the beginning, I was a fan of it. I may have changed a few things about it here and there, but then it just got progressively worse. There was that one season that would not end. It became a running joke. Will this season of NXT ever end? I think actually EC3 may have been part of that season. And I couldn't even tell you who ended up winning. It just ended up not being a priority. It was treated like a joke. And so when you treat your own TV show like a joke, for example, Michael Cole, who was doing the heel shtick at the time, he would do commentary with Josh Matthews for the shows, and he would just blatantly not pay attention. He would get a cell phone call. He would get up in the middle of the show and take a phone call. He would say, oh my God, is this match still going on? Stuff like that. It just turned into a complete joke. But at the very beginning, I'm with you. You know, I was a fan of the show, just not when it turned into a joke and they had some of those challenges that they had, you know, like running around the ring with like a barrel, like the barrel run and other stupid shit they had those guys doing. It was just completely pointless, and it killed the whole concept of the show for me. This comes from Matthew. I watched a shoot interview with Zeus not too long ago. He brought up that if he never left WWE after the promotion for No Holds Barred was done, he was set to face Hulk Hogan at WrestleMania 6 and beat Hogan clean and end Hulkamania. I tend to believe this because Hogan and Zeus never had a real one-on-one match. I bring this up because at the time, the Ultimate Warrior was red hot. If Hogan versus Zeus happened, where would that leave the Ultimate Warrior for WrestleMania 6? Hogan versus Zeus was the original plan in a singles match for WrestleMania 6. I had never heard that Zeus was going to go over clean on Hogan. That just seems completely preposterous to me. I think that's him. That's pie in the sky right there that he's talking about. That was never going to happen. If it was Hogan versus Zeus, that match would have ended exactly the way their match ended in the movie. Maybe not with Zeus dying in the middle of the ring, but Hogan getting his hand raised. I have no doubt about that. But at some point, the plans changed, and it became babyface versus babyface, Hogan versus Warrior. How would that have gone for Warrior if Zeus would have gotten the spot instead? I imagine that Ultimate Warrior would have defended the Intercontinental title against somebody on that show. Maybe Mr. Perfect. That might have been the match. But he was the Intercontinental champion at the time, so he would have had an IC title defense. Probably would have won. And maybe we would have gotten Hogan versus Warrior at WrestleMania the following year. Joseph from Connecticut. Do you think the SmackDown segment in 2003, where Zach Gowen was going up against Brock Lesnar and Zach's mother was in the audience and Brock was teasing her and literally destroying her son in front of her, was too good or too graphic? It wasn't graphic enough, as far as I'm concerned. That was an awesome angle. Go back and watch that if you want to see what a great pro wrestling angle really is. And I also got a kick out of it when Brock took Zach. After that beating, Zach was in a wheelchair, and he took Zach, and he, in the wheelchair, shoved him down a flight of stairs. That was quite enjoyable. But the segment was awesome. I mean, the kid's mother, and again, at that time, Zach Gowen was, I don't even think he was 20. He may have been like 19 years old. He had the one leg. You know, it was a gimmick that they were using him for. You know, the first one-legged wrestler in WWE. And Brock, as Joseph said, destroyed him in every sense of the word. He gave him one of the most wicked chair shots to the skull I've ever heard. The sound that it made, I could still hear it in my head. He did a great blade job, unless he busted him hard way. He was bleeding all over the place like a stuck pig, and he took Zach up on his shoulders with his one good leg, and he F5'd that one good leg into the post, I think, two different times, and Zach's mother wasn't backing down. I mean, she was getting up in Brock's face, and Brock was up in her face, and she kept screaming, "Leave him alone! Leave him alone!" And the image of this kid in a pool of his own blood with his mother over his body was such an awesome way to get Brock Lesnar over as this monster heel. And you won't see anything like that today in WWE. It's PG, and they're too afraid, and they have sponsors, and blah, blah, blah. But I wish every now and then if we got an angle as strong as that one. I can't tell you how effective that is. As a fan, I'm watching that, and I felt sympathy for the guy. And I just looked at Brock, and I said, God, this guy is a freaking monster. You know, he is an evil monster. And there's really nobody on the roster now that I feel that way about. It's just like, okay, they're playing the role of monster, except Brock. I still look at Brock and think this guy is a monster who could tear me limb from limb at the snap of his fingers if he wanted to. I thought it was effective. It was not too graphic at all. I would like to see them do more angles like that in the future, but they won't. That kind of violence and the blood and everything, you just can't get away with that now. So at least we have that on tape. Go on YouTube and find that. Since you can't find it on the WWE Network, go on YouTube and look for it. It's worth taking a look at if you never saw that before. Dan writes in, John Cena has been champion 15 times now in his career. Out of all of his title reigns, do you remember which one actually was memorable and felt special? I just finished watching Eddie Guerrero win the title against Brock Lesnar in No Way Out, and that one title win felt like it had more feeling and passion behind it than all of Cena's title reigns combined. I just can't remember the last time Cena won the belt and made it feel special and brought passion to it. When is the last time you remember Cena winning the belt and actually bringing the passion that we saw during Eddie's days as champion? He never did. Few people could bring that kind of passion to winning the title like Eddie did. You know, not just Cena. I think the moment for Eddie, the story behind it, nobody ever saw him as being a champion. Nobody ever saw him as being on that level. He had a lot of demons that he battled through to come back. You know, Cena never had any demons. Cena's just, you know, Cena's a straight-laced guy. There's really, Cena's boring. That's the whole point of John Cena. You know, Eddie Guerrero had all these demons and these problems and, you know, arrests, and he was down just in the ditches, the lowest of lows, and he worked his way back up, and it was this great story. I think for John Cena, there never was a story. The only story with Cena was they had some footage of him dressed up as Hulk Hogan as a kid, and he talked about how he used to be a fan. Meanwhile, from what I understand, it wasn't like he was a fan from being a kid and he never stopped. I think he got out of wrestling. I know he became a, you know, a big fan of bodybuilding, and then he ended up falling back into wrestling. So they never usually tell that part of the story, but that was always my impression. But, you know, he grew up a fan, and he became a star. That's it. Cena's very boring and very vanilla in a lot of ways, and Eddie, you can't say that Eddie was vanilla. You know, certainly he had his ups and downs, and it was an interesting career path that he took, and it meant so much when he won that championship, and he won it in his hometown, and his family was there, and people went nuts. It was great. It was just a great feel-good moment, whereas now John Cena wins the title, and you know, they try to make it sound like Boston is his hometown. He grew up in West Newbury. I'm not sure how far West Newbury is from Boston, but every time they go to Boston, he's in his hometown. He's in his hometown. He's in his home state. He's not in his hometown. But they say he is, and it just makes them look so bad because he gets booed. He gets booed more than he gets cheered in his supposed hometown. It's not the same thing. And, when I look back at all of Cena's title wins from that first one against JBL until the most recent one at Money in the Bank, he never had that same level of passion. It never came through the way that it did when Eddie won the belt. You know, CM Punk. CM Punk had that, I think, at Madison Square Garden when he beat Del Rio for the WWE title at Survivor Series. That wasn't his first reign. It was the start of the 434-day run that he had. But from having Howard Finkel announce him to the ring to winning the title in Madison Square Garden, diving into the front row in that sea of fans, I just remember Punk had this big smile on his face. Like, you couldn't slap that smile off his face. He was so happy to have had that moment. It probably meant more to him, I'm guessing, than winning the title from Cena in Chicago at Money in the Bank did. Just knowing the history of that building in New York and having the Fink announce him as the new champion, and as a fan, knowing all of the guy's struggles coming up from the indies, the backstage politics holding him down. Paul Heyman has told the story before. They wanted Heyman to fire Punk when Heyman was in charge of Ohio Valley. The directive came down from the top, get rid of him. And he fought for him. He said, I'm not going to do it. You want to fire him, you do it yourself. I think you're making a big mistake. And he fought for the guy, and he saved his career. That's why he's a Paul Heyman guy. That's not just a storyline. That's reality. So there's a lot of interesting twists and turns to the CM Punk story, just like there was a lot of interesting twists and turns and highs and lows with the Eddie Guerrero story. So, you know, I give Punk as an example of somebody who I think had that same kind of passion with that title win, so I remember that one. Plus, I was in the building that night, so maybe I'm a little biased. Daniel Bryan winning the title the first time at SummerSlam when he beat John Cena before the cash-in. That was another. I remember watching this guy killing himself in a match in a hotel ballroom in front of 700 people because I was there, I saw it. And like Eddie, being told you're too small to be WWE champion. Now, John Cena never got told you're too small. John Cena was... They called him the frickin' prototype. That was his name in developmental. That's what he was. He was the prototype. He was the exact prototype for what they looked for. You know, Cena did have, you know, there was one interesting, I guess, twist in the Cena story in that he was this close from getting cut. And what saved him was being the Vanilla Ice, dressing up as Vanilla Ice on that one Halloween episode of SmackDown. And I guess Stephanie McMahon saw him and he was like battle rapping and she was very impressed. And that's when they made the decision to run with him as this thug rapper character, you know, the Doctor of Thugonomics. So that was his big break. He also, it sounds like, came very close to being cut. I'm not sure why you would cut a guy who looked like John Cena, but even John Cena came very close to being cut and got saved by that one little thing. But, I mean, aside from that, there really isn't much. It's a very hollow story, I think, that he has. It's a very basic, vanilla kind of story when you compare it to an Eddie Guerrero, a Daniel Bryan, a CM Punk, or any of those kind of guys. Here's one way I would describe it. Eddie won the title, and it felt like a wrestler won it. Cena won the title, and it felt like a guy playing the role of wrestler had won it. That's the best way I can describe it. And since then, look, it's been how many years? Cena's proven himself to be a wrestler. Not just the guy playing a wrestler. He's worked his ass off at it. Say what you want to about his wrestling skills. But that's how it felt at that time. And the 14 times since then that he won the belt, none of those wins have come close to matching the emotion of Eddie winning the belt from Brock. I can't even remember half of the title wins that he had. He's had so many of them. Graham, GSM Matthews, I've been racking my brain the last few days since CM Punk's official departure. Is Punk the greatest WWE superstar to never main event a WrestleMania? I know he's been in headlining matches, of course, but never the main event. The only other name that comes to mind is Ric Flair, but as you've said on your show, he's not one of the greatest WWE stars of all time. Wrestling, yes, but not WWE, or at least in my opinion, since he accomplished so much elsewhere. Rick Rude, Razor Ramon, and Diesel are some others that have never main evented either, and Diesel is the only one I could think of who could have when he was challenging for the title in the 90s. I would actually disagree on Flair. The thing with Flair came up about the opening segment of WrestleMania and whether Flair was one of the greatest WWE stars of all time. Flair does not outrank Hogan, Austin, Rock, okay, even Undertaker, Shawn, guys like that. But to say, like, you know, is Ric Flair not qualified to have been in a WrestleMania main event? Is he not the biggest name to have not been in a WrestleMania main event? You could make that argument. In this conversation, it's a little bit different. And again, he's another guy who was in a main event of WrestleMania. He just didn't close the show. So what do you mean when you say main event? Are we talking the final match on the card? Because Flair was part of what they called a double main event at WrestleMania 8. So some people might say that that counts, even though Hogan Sid closed the show. That was when the Warrior made his big surprise comeback. For this argument, I would disagree on Flair. You could certainly keep him in that conversation. Bruno Sammartino, I think, would be at the top of the list, unless we're just counting people from the time the WrestleMania era started, from like 85 on. I guess Bruno just predated that. He had retired a few years before the first WrestleMania. But Bruno would have to be on that list, I would think. It's kind of weird to me to think that Bruno, you know, never headlined a WrestleMania show because he had already retired. It feels like he should have main evented one, you know, if WrestleMania had come along a few years earlier, I'm sure he would have. He's this, like, iconic figure, champion for 8 years. Bruno, I think, would be at the top of most people's lists. But if we're talking only from the Mania era on forward, I think Punk would be way up there, but so would Eddie Guerrero. He wrestled Kurt Angle for the title of WrestleMania 20. Didn't headline the show. I think he would probably be up there, too. Graham also wants to know, I've heard you say before when asked that your favorite superstars currently were The Shield, but since they've broken up, who would you say is your favorite superstar now? Dean Ambrose. So The Shield lives on. I'd say Dean Ambrose. David from Houston, I know Dean Malenko is now a road agent for WWE, but what led to the end of his in-ring career? Dean is always left out of the conversation of technical wrestling dream matches with wrestlers like Kurt Angle or Daniel Bryan. If you could see Dean Malenko in one more match, who would it be against? I wouldn't, because he's past his prime, he's old, he's retired, I don't need to see Dean Malenko wrestle again. But if he was going to wrestle again, and he was more in his prime, but he was wrestling guys of today, I think Malenko would match up really well with the smaller guys. He always worked well with the smaller guys, I think, in those cruiserweight matches. The matches he had with Rey Mysterio were just outstanding. If he were in his prime today, I think he could have helped a guy like a Sin Cara. Sin Cara, you know, in some ways was working with the wrong people. They put him in there, I know, with Chavo Guerrero, figured that they would have a good match, and he couldn't even have a good match with Chavo. Then they wanted to bring in Averno from Mexico, who was one of his all-time best opponents down there. I don't know if they ever signed Averno or they came close to, but then I think Sin Cara got hurt. Poor Averno got fucked out of a run in WWE because of it. But then he came back and, you know, they would put him in there with anybody, and I think he needed to be in there with the right person. A guy like a Dean Malenko in there with Sin Cara, I think, the original Sin Cara, could have made him look real good, could have helped him get over. I think that Malenko against Adrian Neville, if they were to promote Adrian Neville from NXT and Malenko was around and there's his first program, Neville against Malenko, I think that could have been a hell of a program. Even the newer signings like Kenta, okay, Prince Devitt probably on his way in. Once Devitt actually signs, okay, he'll be officially in WWE. Those guys against the Iceman, I think that'd be a pretty good first feud for them in WWE. Jay from Atlanta, I got to thinking about Ahmed Johnson the other day while watching In Your House International Incident, which involved him in the six-man main event. He was the Intercontinental Champion at that point, but the next night on Raw, he got injured by Farouk, and despite winning a WWE Championship opportunity in a Battle Royal 2 weeks later, he was forced to vacate the Intercontinental title. Do you think he could have been WWE Champion had he stayed healthy, and how high do you think his ceiling was in the company? I don't think he would have been WWE champion. He could have gotten to main event level. I just don't think he ever would have ended up with the belt. I think the timing was all wrong. Look, I mean, if he got over, if the fans were reacting to him, business started to pick up, that's a different story. I never got that impression. He was popular, but he was never popular at that level. And maybe we'll never know because he got hurt. Farouk legit injured him. I think it was a kick to the kidney. He had a lot of kidney problems after that. He did win a title shot, but I don't think he ever cashed in on that because he got hurt and he had to vacate the other belt and he was out for a few months. I think he might have even been on kidney dialysis for a while. Farouk really fucking messed him up with that kick. But I think he would have fallen just short of being the champion. And he didn't have the promo skills. And part of it was just bad timing. You know, that was Shawn Michaels' time. And when things didn't work out with Shawn, they did put the belt on Sid. Would they have put the belt on Ahmed instead? I don't think so. I just don't think it was ever in the cards. And I think with who was on top at that time, with Shawn, Sid, Austin coming around, Brett, even Undertaker, you know, I don't see where Ahmed fits in the championship picture. Jay's other question here, do I think option C has hurt the X division in TNA since the title becomes a hot potato around this time? It was cool when Austin Aries did it in 2012. Now it just seems they're doing it for the sake of doing it, and it's devaluing the belt. It's their money in the bank. That's what they stole. They stole the concept from WWE. It's clearly a ripoff of Money in the Bank. I don't have a problem with it. They do it once a year. It's not like they're doing option C every other month. Then I would say yes, they're overusing it. The X Division belt, it's devaluing the belt. Really, the X Division title has value. The X Division title has not had value in years. There's no value left to dwindle. I mean, it's just that the belt doesn't mean anything. It really doesn't. And so Aries cashing in for another title shot, which he may end up doing. He probably will end up doing if I had to take a guess. That, you know, it's just a gimmick. Like I said, it's their money in the bank. I don't have a problem with it. Eddie is a longtime listener. He says, "What is your favorite Nitro moment?" I know for me it was the night Goldberg beat Hollywood Hogan for the WCW title in front of a sold-out Georgia Dome crowd in Atlanta. Funny story behind that sold-out crowd is that they had a legit 40,000 people in the Georgia Dome that night for Nitro, and yet on commentary, I could have sworn, Tony Schiavone went out on commentary and was told to say that they had a packed crowd of 39,000 here in the Georgia Dome. You know, now, I've heard of wrestling companies exaggerating attendance before, rounding off numbers to make it look more impressive. If you have a legit 40,000 people in the building, why the fuck would you have your announcer say that you have 39,000? Only in WCW. Anyway, Eddie says the Hogan-Goldberg match is probably his favorite, which, by the way, Eric Bischoff was crazy not to hold that match off for a pay-per-view like Bash at the Beach, where they probably would have made a ton of money. Well, that was WCW. WCW did not live for pay-per-view. WCW lived for TV ratings. That was what was most important to them. They were in a war. They wanted a win. And, yeah, they probably cost themselves a lot of money by doing that. Especially since Bash at the Beach, I think that pay-per-view was 6 days later. The pay-per-view was that weekend. And Goldberg went out on Nitro. He beat Hogan. And what ended up happening? I think Goldberg went to the pay-per-view 6 days later, I think, and defended the World Heavyweight Championship against Kurt Hennig. No offense to Kurt Hennig. I am a big Mr. Perfect mark. But Goldberg versus Kurt Hennig for the title underneath is not how the world champion should have been positioned. Hogan, I think, was in the main event, of course. I think it was probably a tag match with Dennis Rodman or something. So yeah, that was completely stupid, but that probably is my favorite Nitro moment, too. I just remember when Goldberg got the pin on Hogan, and they had this wide shot of the crowd. Everybody was just jumping up and down. They were celebrating, high-fiving. It was tremendous. It was just a tremendous moment. And I think one of the reasons that Bischoff wanted that match on that show, there were a bunch of Turner executives, I think, in the audience that night at the Georgia Dome, and so he really wanted to impress them by packing as many people as he could. And so they wanted to be able to promote a big championship match for ticket sales. So that may have had a lot to do with it. I still think they were insane not to hold off on the match, but that's probably a big reason why he did that. That probably would be at the top of my list. You know what? There's two other moments that stand out to me, and they both involve Sting. We saw plenty of NWO beatdowns and Sting coming out with the baseball bat. I can't tell you how many times we saw that on Nitro. But two of my favorite moments and most memorable moments from Nitro. One was the time that they actually, you know what? There's three, and all three involve Sting. One of them was when they had an army of Sting lookalikes come from all over the building, out of the crowd, down the aisle. There were a bunch of fake Stings wearing Sting masks. And the NWO was in the ring. They were beating down all the baby faces. And one of the fake Stings walking down to the ring with the Sting mask turned out to be the real Sting. And we found that out when Buff Bagwell took a shot at him, and he didn't sell it. And the crowd knew at that point, and then he pulled the mask off and they went crazy. That was a cool moment. Another one was when Sting came out. NWO, again, was in the ring beating down the baby faces. Sting comes down to the ring, down the aisle, climbs inside. He has the baseball bat. All the heels scatter. They leave the ring. Sting takes the baseball bat, holds it out, drops it outside the ring. He drops his weapon. And I think you probably had a lot of people in the crowd at that point who were thinking, oh shit, he's going to join up with them. Savage was the first one in the ring. He went right after Sting, and Sting attacked him. Sting beat him up. All the heels came in. Sting fought them all off, and the place went apeshit. Absolutely apeshit. It was such a great moment. And the other one that stands out to me was, yet again, another NWO beat down of the babyfaces, and Diamond Dallas Page was one of them. He had been beaten down. Sting descended from the rafters, and he descended from the rafters to save DDP. I don't remember why. I don't remember what was going on at the time, but he hooked his harness to DDP, I guess his belt loop or whatever, or put the harness around DDP. And this looked a little weird because all the heels had to keep their distance from Sting as he fumbled around with this harness. So that kind of looked a little stupid. But the end visual of the show, once he had DDP hooked in, was they lifted Sting back up into the air, and he had DDP hooked to him. So both guys got like airlifted back up into the rafters. It was actually a really cool visual. That stands out to me as well. So yeah, I was a big fan of the Crow Sting character and a lot of the stuff they did with him back then. And those are probably the Nitro moments that stand out to me the most. Finally here, Kim from New York City. If Steve Austin did not turn heel in 2001 and continued as a babyface, do you think the fans would have gotten sick of him and turned on him like they did John Cena? Absolutely not. They would have gotten sick of him, I think, at some point. to some degree. I think babyface Austin already was cooling off at that time. I'm not completely disagreeing with Austin that it was time for a change, even though it turned out to be a really poor decision. And maybe, you know, if I were in charge, would I have turned him heel in Texas on that night? Probably not. But Austin never had the same popularity to me when he came back from neck surgery that he did before he left. You know, a lot of that magic was gone. Some of the audience had already left. I think when Austin went away, so did a lot of that casual audience. It started to erode a little bit. You put anybody on top for long enough, people are going to get sick and tired of them. But would they have turned on him the way they turned on John Cena? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Never in a million years would they have turned on Austin or Rock, but especially Austin, the way that they did John Cena. A lot of the John Cena hate has to do with the character he portrays. Steve Austin never portrayed a character anywhere close to the kind of character John Cena portrays. So I think the worst thing for Austin that would have happened, maybe there would have been some scattered boos, but the reactions just wouldn't have been as loud as they used to be. I think that's the extent to which you would have seen that. They never in a million years would have turned on him the way that they turned on John Cena. Going to wrap up with some thoughts on CM Punk in a second, but first, got to go back in the time machine here for another sound-off throwback. This time we're going back 1 year. 1 year ago today, in fact, I recorded episode 284, which was the first sound-off coming off the split from SE Scoops, and it was July 20th of 2013. I pulled what I thought was just a brief clip, an interesting clip, looking back at the NXT debut of Charlotte, the reigning NXT Women's Champion, and also a debut vignette for another newcomer to NXT.
It's time to go back in time.
Speaking of Arn Anderson, his former best friend, the Nature Boy, Ric Flair, made his way down to the ring, hot on the heels of having a warrant issued for his arrest after failing to pay alimony to ex-wife number 3. Or maybe it's number 4, I don't know, I've lost count. He was there to introduce his daughter Charlotte in her debut match against Bayley. Flair stayed out there in his daughter's corner, and at one point he took off his jacket. I think Charlotte was getting the hell beat out of her at one point. He took off his jacket, he threw it to the ground, he started pounding on the canvas as a way to motivate her. You see, this is why Flair would make a great manager, I think, on the main roster. And not for nothing, Charlotte looked really good out there, especially, you know, it was her debut match. You could tell that she has a gymnastics background with the way that she contorts her body and some of the moves that she does that require a level of flexibility that I will never have if I live to be 100. She finished Bayley off with this move. I don't know what it's called, but it's like a somersault into a snapmare. Like, Bayley is laying on the mat on her stomach, and it's this somersault into a snapmare that sends Bayley face first into the mat. It's the best way I could describe it. It looked tremendous. So, a good debut for the Nature Girl. She even busted out some woos during the match, so it's not like she's hiding from the fact that Ric Flair is her father. She's embracing it. We then got a glimpse, very briefly, of this new guy, Tyler Breeze. Only from behind. He would not let us see his face. He said, "Next week we will witness gorgeous." So I guess he's doing the old model gimmick that Rick Martel used to have. I wonder whatever happened to that Tyler Breeze guy. But Charlotte, you know, it's funny to look back on that. That was her first match on TV, and she was good even then. Now, of course, she's even better. And imagine how she'll be 3 years from now, 5 years from now. You know, she's a great athlete. She's got the pedigree, obviously, in her family, the genes. So she could end up going down. I mean, it's too early to say this, of course, but it could be that one day we look back on her as being maybe the greatest diva they've ever had. You know, and 1 year later, she's already got the title, and she could end up on the main roster in a few months. She was on the Madison Square Garden house show last weekend. You know, she was there with, I think her father was not in her corner. I think he was actually out there for a Lumberjack main event. But Charlotte was one of the NXT people they had on the Madison Square Garden show, and they wouldn't just have somebody on there if they weren't planning, I think, on doing something with them soon. So in just 1 year's time, she has come a long way, and I think she can only get better from here. Finally, this week marked the official end of the CM Punk era in WWE. His contract is believed to have expired this past week. There's been some debate on exactly which day it was. Was it on Tuesday? Was it on Thursday, which would have been July 17th, the exact date of the Money in the Bank pay-per-view back in 2011? There were a lot of rumors that he did not re-sign a deal with the company until the day of that show. It was backstage, so it would make sense if it was the 17th. And I remember reading at that time that he had extended his deal for 3 years, and those 3 years are up. They did not roll over his deal. He did not re-sign. He is gone. He is not going to be at Battleground tonight making a surprise appearance. I know there are still some Punk fans out there holding out hope. When the hashtag Thank You Punk started trending on Twitter, he went on Twitter and posted a note that said, "No, thank you. Thanks for all the help and support through the years. Health and happiness above all. Don't ever take any shit from anybody." Good advice to live by no matter what you do for a living, whether you're a wrestler or not. So I thought that in the spirit of Punk's run coming to an end, I would go ahead and pen a column on five of his best matches in WWE, which is what I did. You can go up and check the article out right now. It's up on pwmania.com. I've linked to it on my Twitter page. There's links to it up on Facebook. So you can head on over. It's one of the featured articles on the right-hand side if you scroll down on PWMania. It is a column listing five of CM Punk's best matches, his most memorable matches, including a couple I think that sometimes get overlooked. I did include the ECW title win over John Morrison back in 2007. I included a triple threat match with Alberto Del Rio and The Miz, two of my favorite wrestlers, as many of you know. But they actually had a kick-ass TLC match back in 2011 that I think gets forgotten about a lot. It was not the best TLC match of all time, but it was a damn good match I think that people should go back and check out if you have the network. And, you know, some of the other matches you would expect. The match with Brian at Over the Limit in 2011. They had that great championship match. Punk and Brock at SummerSlam 2 years ago, which I thought was the match of the year in WWE that year. We had Punk and John Cena. Money in the Bank 2011, one of my favorite all-time matches. It was just magic. Everything from the crowd reaction, being in Chicago, the stuff that was happening behind the scenes, some of which we knew about, some of which we didn't. The relatively clean, I can't call it a totally clean finish because there was a distraction, I guess, from Vince and John Laurinaitis. But for the most part, a clean pinfall win over John Cena. Those things are rare. And Punk fleeing the arena through the crowd and putting the belt in his refrigerator. It's just an all-time classic. So I talk a little bit about those matches and some other points about Punk as well. So you can go on pwmania.com, check it out, leave some feedback, leave some comments, let me know what you think. And all the best to CM Punk. Hopefully he's happy. He's stuffing his face with pizza and ice cream and going to hockey games, and I think he's going to be starting a podcast soon, so I guess I'll have some more competition. Competition's always good. So best of luck to him. And if you have questions for the mailbag, email them to me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. You could follow me on Twitter, @solemonster. I'll be live tweeting during the pay-per-view tonight, during Raw tomorrow night, as I do every single week. We just passed 6,000 followers, so a big thank you to everybody who's following me now on Twitter. You could send me a Facebook friend request. The Solemonster with the extra E is my profile name. We have a Facebook group as well. You can apply for membership, and I will approve you. Some of you, not all of you. And we are on YouTube. Again, there's new YouTube content up. 75 minutes of bonus audio. It's like a bonus sound-off. Sound-off inbox, the first installment. So head on over there. Check that out. If you look in the video description, there is a link to the MP3 if you just want the audio and you want to load it up to listen to on the go. You can do that. Just check out the link in the video description and subscribe to our channel there. Please stream us on Stitcher and leave us a review. You could do the same in iTunes as well. And we are now on TuneIn Radio. If the episodes are not up on our page when you are listening to this, it will be shortly. It may take a couple days to push some of our episodes to TuneIn, but we were just approved, so we are now on there. There's a TuneIn Radio app. You can go on the website. Just another way to stream the show and keep in tune with the sound off. So thank you for your continued support. Make a PayPal donation if you want to show your support for the show on thesolemonster.com. And that's about it. Enjoy Battleground tonight. Those of you who are checking it out, the show is pretty strong on paper. I think it's going to be a good show. So check it on out. We will be back next weekend, episode 338 of The Sound Off. Until then, be well, stay safe, and we will see you right back here again next time. Take care, guys.
You've been listening to the Sala Monster Sounds Off, giving you the good.
Charlotte into the cover of Natalya! Charlotte's the NXT Women's Champion!
The bad.
We officially strip Daniel Bryan of the WWE World Heavyweight Championship.
It's a good night to be right.
And the ugly.
I made the mistake of reading Vince Russo's blog. He talks about how it's not creative. No, it's the crowds that are dead, and it's all theme park visitors who come inside because it's too hot outside. 900 people did not wander into the fucking impact zone because grandma was about to keel over from heat stroke.
Well, mostly the good.
Some monster sounds off.
Since 2007. On the Salamonster.com, Stitcher Radio, and iTunes.
Solo Monsters Sound Off.